stages in darkness and clear. We're raising the curtain, and no one's quite certain who's played. Listen then, if we'd known just how right we were going to be. For we dreamed a lot, and we schemed a lot, and we tried to sing of love before the stage fell apart.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, October 25th, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by app, phone, or browser. If anyone would like to email us a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up on our scripture reading where we left off. We're in the Gospel of Luke, and we're in chapter, let's see, I think it's 7. Yep, chapter 7, read by Alexander Scorby. Okay, chapter 7.
Chapter 7. Now when he had ended all his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loveth our nation, and he hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them. And when he was now not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. Wherefore, neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee. But say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say unto one, Go, and he goeth, and to another, Come, and he cometh, and to my servant, Do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turned him about, and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole that had been sick. And it came to pass the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and much people. Now when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and much people of the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said unto her, Weep not. And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said, Young man, I say unto thee, Arise. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. And he delivered him to his mother. And there came a fear on all, and they glorified God, saying that a great prophet is risen up among us, and that God hath visited his people. And this rumor of him went forth throughout all Judea and throughout all the region round about. And the disciples of John showed him of all these things. And John, calling unto him two of his disciples, sent them to Jesus, saying, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another? When the men were come unto him, they said, John Baptist hath sent us unto thee, saying, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another? And in that same hour he cured many of their infirmities and plagues, and of evil spirits, and unto many that were blind he gave sight. Then Jesus answering said unto them, Go your way, and tell John what things ye have seen and heard, how that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, to the poor the gospel is preached. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me. And when the messengers of John were departed, he began to speak unto the people concerning John. What went ye out into the wilderness for to see? A reed shaken with the wind? But what went ye out for to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they which are gorgeously apparelled and live delicately are in king's courts. But what went ye out for to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and much more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. For I say unto you, among those that are born of women, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. But he that is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. And all the people that heard him and the publicans justified God, being baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and lawyers rejected the counsel of God against themselves, being not baptized of him. And the Lord said, Whereunto then shall I liken the men of this generation? And to what are they like? They are like unto children sitting in the marketplace, and calling one to another, and saying, We have piped unto you, and ye have not danced. We have mourned to you, and ye have not wept. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and ye say, He hath a devil. The Son of Man is come eating and drinking, and ye say, Behold, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. But wisdom is justified of all her children. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, and stood at his feet behind him, weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw it, he spake within himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto thee. And he saith, Master, say on. There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence, and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? Simon answered and said, I suppose that he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, Thou hast rightly judged. And he turned to the woman and said unto Simon, Seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house. Thou gavest me no water for my feet, but she hath washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman since the time I came in hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little. And he said unto her, Thy sins are forgiven. And they that sat at meat with him began to say within themselves, Who is this that forgiveth sins also? And he said to the woman, Thy faith hath saved thee. Go in peace.
Okay, we've got the Q&A open. We're going to pick up a subject tonight. Let me just reset my my page here. Okay, tonight we're going to take a look at slavery. Excuse me, slavery in America. I know we've looked at this, so maybe in the beginning of the year, earlier this year, sometime we looked at this. And I think what we did is I did a video that I put together on it, and I think I uploaded it, and it didn't come out too good anyway. So we're going to do it again anyway tonight. And the main reason I want to cover this, slavery in America, is because of a conversation I heard last week and with individuals down in New York City, and I know Trump was responding to this, concerning the removal of the statue of George Washington. And Trump asked the question, are you going to remove Jefferson too? And they talked about slavery, and everybody was very ignorant to what the true story is about slavery in America. So I want to revisit that tonight and take a look at that. But before we do that, Jan, how many questions do we have, or do we have any announcements to make first? Did we lose Jan? Oh, no, he's here. He's just muted.
I think he said that he had
five questions tonight, John.
Five questions. Okay, let's take them, and let's do those questions first, and do we have any announcements?
No, just questions tonight.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll have one little announcement we'll make after the questions, but let's take the questions first.
In what elected position can we make the greatest impact in our community? Committeeman, town supervisor, county legislator?
Well, I believe taking the position of the people in the Committee of Safety could make the biggest effect and control and work to take back our republic in that process. So I would say, to really get a Committee of Safety going and spend your time there. I have taken a different position on committeemen. I've had sort of an epiphany recently, realizing all of the restrictions that are upon the committeemen and how the whole system is codified. And our founding fathers did not codify that position. We know that the committees of safety kind of, you know, went into becoming morphed into the committee man, where, of course, you know, all of the work that the committee of safety would have been doing and should have been doing was taking place, and of course, controlling the political process back then. But somehow, as time went on, it was codified. And I did a little research on that, and we'll talk about that another time as far as the details of that codification and information. And I'm rewriting the information on the committeemen in the handbooks that we have. We have a committeeman handbook. I'm going to rewrite that. And we have some information on the committeemen, of course, in the Committee of Safety handbook. And basically, the people... We don't need to be elected to be committeemen. We can take total control over the whole process without becoming elected. We saw how in California they recalled a governor. Well, that's the job and the work of a committeeman. The other thing I know over the years, especially a couple of years ago, I was more involved in trying to help some local people get elected, and we were trying to help a guy run for Senate. U.S. Senate here in New York, and numerous other people, and we assisted in whatever ways we could, and we walked the petitions. One of the problems with the committeeman process is if you're going to walk a petition, you can only walk a petition of an individual within your party. You can't do it outside that party. So that restriction injures our ability to really be free to support the people we want. The other thing is that when they have the primary, and I had done some research in the primary and found some things again about that, and that's kind of a recent thing, the primaries. Although they've been working at it since the 1800s, by the time of the turn of the century, there was barely 20 states that were involved with working that process out. But everything was kind of up in the air, and it wasn't until many years later that really it stabilized. And I think it was actually 1970 when all the states participated, with the exception of a couple. I know New Hampshire was one of them, and they do something with a caucus. but the primary elections, it cuts a lot of people out. And, people, I know in certain states, in a very few states, you can... get involved in the primary election whether you're in that party or not. And that's an important factor, I think, that needs to be. Parties are destructive. I wrote a paper on that, and maybe we're going to talk a little more about that in the near future, and definitely get that information out to the people who are building committees of safety. So these committees of safety really can be the committeemen. We can walk petitions. And how we can get around, at least for right now, we can get around not having to be in a party by becoming a notary. And we could do that online. Matter of fact, I do know somewhere on our website we posted that information up for people to become a notary for some other things we were doing. And it's a pretty simple process. So I think the people in the committees of safety should all consider, becoming notaries at least for a while in order to run through the process of walking papers for anyone, no matter what party they're in, because notaries can walk the petition and sign it. And that's one way to get around it, and then we're open to be able to walk papers for anyone, whether they're in a party or no party, and get them onto the ballot through petition. Now, there's a lot of changes that need to be made because of the codification of all of, well, again, election law is important in the process, but of course it's been all robbed from us and designed in such a way to keep the people really away from having freedom to be able to really work the process as they would like to do. And over time, I think we can fix that. But nevertheless, we can walk papers, we can put people in office, we can take people out of office, and we don't need to be elected to do that. And that's the most powerful part of the whole process. So I'm going to rewrite the committeeman book for the process of being able to use it through as the committees of safety. And we'll get into more detail about that at a later time. I would say, of course, the committeeman is a pretty powerful position, but now the Committee of Safety is the more powerful position because we're working towards the controlling of the courts that the people have an unalienable right to do. Those court systems are to be ruled over and decided by the people and by the people alone, without any interference with any elected or servant or even an appointed servant or the prosecutor or anyone. We the people decide whether we're going to give an indictment or not, and we the people decide whether someone is guilty or not, and we the people decide what the punishment should be, if any, and it should be an eye on restitution and not an eye necessarily on prison. In certain situations, prison would be a necessity, but generally speaking, it shouldn't be as a norm. Most people in jail just don't believe but belong there. I would say Justice Bork said, I'm not sure that I remember, he said 80 or 90%. I'll take the lower number. 80% of the people that are in jail are only there because they opened their mouth. They pleaded. They made a plea because they don't have the power or the authority. But even that is a fraud. The pleading is a fraud because you're being suckered into the system, you're being drawn into the system, and the system is abusing the people and the individuals. We need to teach our sheriffs that they should not be accepting prisoners that are coming from any of the town courts, the village courts, and most city courts. New York City would be one exception because here in New York, the Constitution says that the New York City courts are courts of record. So they've adapted that as part of the process as any other state court. And of course, the county courts are courts of record too. So again, a court of record is one that's ruled by the people. An equity court is one that's ruled by the judge. And there is an appellate process to that. But you have to be either involved in commercial activity or maybe illegal commercial activity, or working in some kind of an agency. So I know that's kind of a long answer, but there is a lot to it. And I really do think the most powerful position, the most important thing anyone can do, is to start or get involved with the Committee of Safety and take the power and the authority within your county. We need about 250 people. And that may even be a high number for a lot of places, about 250 people in every county to really take total control of the entire county. And that's really not that many, okay, 250 people. And again, we have government not by the majority, but by the majority that participates. So this is what we have to do, and that's where I think people should put their time. Okay, next question, Jan.
Is there a think tank? For conservatives, where we meet patriots that have skills and want to make a difference.
I lost it. What's the first part of that? Is there a think tank?
A think tank.
The question is there, read the question.
Is there a think tank for conservatives where we can meet other patriots that have skills and want to make a difference?
Well, I should hope that right here is a think tank. We try to encourage people to come up with thoughts, ideas, questions, corrections, anything that they could do to add to what we're doing and correct to what we're doing, and get involved in different things. So as far as conservatism is concerned, we really have to become, maybe we'll call ourselves to some degree constitutionalist. Jefferson used Republican and Federalist. Republican sort of connects to a party, so that's kind of a shame. But we are Republicans. We believe in the Republic. We're in the only natural law republic in the entire world. And the last natural law republic that existed was around 1600 B.C. And that was the first and the last, and this is the second and probably the last. We should be really be focusing in on the Constitution, on natural law, focusing in on what we understand as common law. And we should be thinking about those things and working out things to bring our republic back. And every single Committee of Safety must become a think tank. I'm going to kind of throw this in here at the moment because there's going to be an announcement, but I'm going to kind of slide this in to part of this question, and so I won't have to make the announcement anyway. But I'm thinking of putting together, and I'm working on it right now, I don't know whether we want to call it a conference, a seminar. I think a seminar might be the best word to use for it. And I'm going to be running that up in New York, right around the Poughkeepsie area. And we're going to be inviting people from the tri-state area and all the counties around and anybody that wants to show up, and even people up in New England. Sometimes we've had events where people from New England have come. We've had people come up from New York and out of Pennsylvania and Jersey and, you know, to events that we've run in the past some years back. So we're going to do one, and we're going to endeavor to record it. We're working on that possibility to try to record that and actually stream it live. So really everyone can participate and see that. And the whole purpose of that particular program that we're putting together is to introduce people to the Committee of Safety and to lay out the program and break it down on how that process is to work, and how it should be structured, and how we put it together, and how, in a sense, I think when you work through that and collectively put it together, that becomes a think tank, because we're creating the structure, giving them the basics and everything they need, but each county has to add to that their needs. Every county has different needs, different focuses. But the key thing that we're trying to do is get everyone in a uniformed position so that we're kind of interchangeable. To a major degree, as a matter of fact, from county to county and from state to state, and it's easier to communicate, and because we'll all be on the same page, we can all be working on some of the same basic things, especially like the committee man process. You know, it's not just what's involved in your own county that you get involved with, but let's take New York for instance. We have 150 assembly districts, and those assembly districts are gerrymandered throughout the counties. So it's not that you find an assembly district that is just isolated to one county, which, by the way, we have 62 counties and 150 assembly districts. So, you know, there'll have to be some kind of a relationship between the counties, and that's where, you know, the Committee of Correspondence comes in, and also the political committee comes in to work together to try to work that process out during elections, to see who they would support and get onto the ticket. So again, picking up that job of the committee man. So I'm going to, again, rewrite the handbook for the committee man, which will basically operate and run like the committee man process and the procedures and the structures and of course, working through all of the political subdivisions and how things work, but related to liberty, to free individuals who just pick up the mantle, so to speak, and go out there and work to get people onto the ballot that are statesmen, and work to get people out of office that are violating their oath. And so anyway, that's what we're going to be working on. And this particular, seminar, if we call it a seminar, will teach the people the structure and put it together. I'm thinking of putting it together. It'll probably be about 3 hours. We have a half-hour introduction to the Committee of Safety, and I'm thinking and hoping that the PowerPoint I'm putting together will be about 45 minutes, and then after that we get into an answer and question thing where we can get into a lot of different subjects and subject matters and details concerning the Committee of Safety. So hopefully it'll be very rewarding and educational to people and encourage them to create committees of safety in their counties. I had mentioned this earlier in the year, my plan to tour New York State, to go to all the counties or, you know, do 2 or 3 or 4 counties at a time, wherever we can, in order to encourage and stimulate the committees of safety. We haven't been able to do it mostly because of this mask business, but the mask business here in New York has been pretty well shut down in the last few months, and so now is the time to go forward to do that. And hopefully people in other states will do the same. Once I go through New York, maybe I'll go through Connecticut. Connecticut's got 8 counties, so we can get through Connecticut reasonably quickly, and we can work with them also to help get their sheriffs back on board, because their sheriffs have been lost there in Connecticut. And also in Jersey, and possibly even Pennsylvania, and it depends, you know, on how far I'd have to travel to work these things out. But hopefully other people will take what we're doing here. We'll provide all these PowerPoints and whatever video, PowerPoint video we have for the introduction of the Committee of Safety, which we have a very powerful, I think it's a 30-minute video. It's a PowerPoint video. Very, very powerful. And so we'll share all those tools, and anybody that feels confident to be able to do it, just pick it up, the tools, get a room, get the invitations out, get a hold of us. We'll help get the invitations out to the people in your state through our membership and assist you in any way we can. And it would be really nice if we had someone in each state to kind of get out there and spearhead this work that needs to be done. Next question, Jim.
If every municipality in the country is an actual corporation, how do we prop up our constitutional republic? Where do we start?
Again, we get back to the committee, to the committees of safety. Bear in mind, every committee of safety, if we can get maybe two-thirds or three-quarters of the counties involved with committees of safety, and eventually all committees of safety, start educating the people within our counties, getting information out, taking back the control of the courts, which we will be able to do, I believe. We've already set the stage with all of our paperwork in the courts that we've been working on over the years. And we're still filing some stuff. It's been a while since we filed, but we're going to be moving back into filing some more stuff and sort of nailing it to the door of the United States Supreme Court, because they're to blame. And getting all that out, I just lost my train of thought. Repeat the question.
If every municipality in the country is an actual corporation, how do we prop up our constitutional republic? Where do we start?
Okay, like I said, we have to take back our local government. All politics is local. So I like to say all the political process is local, because politics, as we understand it, is really a problem. It's destructive to our system. But once we take back the government, we connect with our sheriff, we bring him on board, and he becomes a constitutional sheriff, and then we start working with all of our local governments, the cities, the towns, the villages, and the county, bringing all of these governments back under the rule of the people, making them understand that they need to obey the Constitution, and if they refuse to respond to us, we'll just take them out of office, because we can do a recall, and we'll have the power and the ability to do that recall. In that process of time, we have the ability to force these municipalities, whether they be a town, city, state, county, whatever, because they've really incorporated everything. There are some counties and towns that are not incorporated. I was surprised to find that out. I think it was Gerard that was telling me about a few places. But generally speaking, most of them throughout the United States are incorporated because we're moving into corporatism, and corporatism is synonymous with Nazism. It's the whole process, really, of taking control of the people, getting the necessary civil law at the municipality levels. But then we can now start to dismantle them, because it's up to the people. The people will demand it, and that's something that... we will encourage and talk about to the committees of safety across America and encourage them to look at these things and start dismantling the New World Order structure that they put up. We also have the Republic Review, which is to go in and to correct all of our laws, starting on the federal level particularly, but we need to bring this down into the state level to get rid of all unconstitutional statutes, codes, regulations, and bring things back in order, bring those things back under equity and the law back under literally the law. So, and make that separation again, because they combined law and equity, called it civil law, and that's what we're under right now, which is synonymous with Babylonian law, which is also called municipality law. So it's got many, many names. It's also called Roman law. It's called Justinian. All the same. It's just a different name at a different time, and it's just to disguise it so that they can move it to the people when they've discovered one, and maybe, you know, they move the other. So, okay, next question.
This person says, I've been sending my employer common law letters to fight the work vaccine mandate. I served them with a conditional acceptance letter and went all the way through the notice of estoppel violation and demand letter. I was told I am ready to go to court. However, I do not have any help from here on out. Everyone is busy dealing with mandates, and I have zero clue on what to do. I just know this common law process seems like the right way to go. I've already had my Skelly hearing, and they gave me the termination date of October 26th. I'm looking for anyone who can help me in this common law process. Would you please refer me to someone or some group that can help advise me on what to do? I am in the county where the headquarters of Google, Twitter, Facebook, and all the big tech giants are. The county is actually my employer. If you would please help me, I could in turn help other county workers who are facing the same problem with their exemptions now.
Well, here's another situation. I mean, it's an important thing to try to deal with and go forward with, but I think we'll be putting a lot of time into that kind of a thing where we need to be putting our time into other places. And for instance, you know, we've had a lot of people who have asked us to help them in different things, but we got to stay focused on dealing with enemies, both foreign and domestic, not only within our federal government, but also within our state government. But the focus really is down on the United States Supreme Court, for to take them out, you know, the New World Order that's fixed inside that whole system and that judiciary, the entire federal judiciary, which stems all the way down to every state judiciary in America, and I mean every single state, and has poisoned and polluted our courts of law. And so we need to be focusing in on that. And it all starts with going after the United States Supreme Court and winning there. And we're not going to win that no matter what we do. We can't win that case until we get to the other side. The other side meaning that arrests have been taking places and a lot of these people are being removed, and then we will could work to remove those who are left that do not respond to the people properly. And then our indictments that we've placed and filed already would then be honored and executed. And many other new indictments would then follow for those who would refuse to acknowledge the common law in the courts. Once we acknowledge the common law in the courts, then the whole, everything is up for to get back to normal, because, you know, then we can get justice. We need courts of justice, and court cases rest on just truth and maxims. So, and maxims, of course, is a truth. And it cannot be denied or argued. And once the courts start to work back to courts of justice and operate under maxims of law, that's when we can get justice, and all of these things will disappear. You know, we sued Facebook and Google and all of them. What was the other ones? There's Facebook, there was Google, there was what's the tweet one, whatever they call that one? Twitter, okay. And I know there was a fourth, Google, Facebook, Twitter. I know there's a fourth one. But anyway, we sued them. One of them defaulted. We sued them for $1 billion apiece. One of them defaulted. And we had a crooked judge up there bringing things back into the system and trying to throw us out. And we're still in that battle. We haven't finished that battle yet. But... you know, again, we're not going to win on this side. And to go up against these big corporations, the pharmaceutical companies, for instance, that are putting forward these particular injections that people are taking, and to sue them, they can't be sued. And a lot of these different problems and situations out there, you know, they've made these statutes where they protected these people. You know, they've written legislation to protect them. Well, that doesn't amount to a hill of beans in a court of law, okay, because court of law doesn't run according to statute. Statutes in a court of law is repugnant. Only natural law is involved and permitted in a common law court. And that's what we're supposed to have. So, you see, that's when we can win all these cases. And I do think we're very close to coming to that positioning. We're very, very close. And so if we put a lot of time into these other cases to go and battle in the courts, you know, we're going to be wasting our time, I believe. Now, if people who want to do this come and ask certain questions here on our open forum, we'll give them some thoughts, ideas, and advice to steer them to a few different things here or there. But they'll have to struggle to work through it to put it together, because we here at National Liberty Alliance must focus our time on to, again, dealing with enemies both foreign and domestic. But on the other hand, by answering some of these questions and giving some information in this open forum, for instance, not only for that case, but for many cases, can become an educational thing and a revelation of how the process works. So come to the meetings and ask the questions, and we'll give you answers. Next.
John, there is a group that does pro bono legal services for these types of issues. The website is https://www.justice.gov/EOIR/list, that's L-I-S-T, dash, pro, P-R-O, dash, bono, B-O-N-O, dash, legal, L-E-G-A-L, dash, service, S-E-R-V-I-C-E, dash, providers, P-R-O-V-I-D-E-R-S. And she might try, and people listening that have the same issues might try going there to see if they can get some help.
Okay, and to have that repeated, you can download the MP3 at the end of the meeting, and you can, you know, scroll back and forth to find that information. But when you started putting that information out, it was something or other .gov. Doesn't that bring us to the government control? I thought only .gov was permitted for government agencies and for, you know, saved for that purpose. Jan?
I'm sorry, John. I could not understand what you were saying there.
What's the first beginning of that website? Don't go through the HTTP and all that, but what's the name of that website, the first part of it? Something.gov/justice or something. The website you just read off.
You want me to repeat the website listing?
I only want to know the name of the beginning name of the website without the www, you know, dot. What's the name of the website?
Okay, it's justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, dot gov.
Okay, stop right there. Justice.gov. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been under the understanding that anytime anybody using .gov can only be a government agency. So if it's justice.gov, you're going to a government agency for assistance. If I'm correct in my thinking, I mean, maybe someone can correct me on that.
It's a government organization.
That's my point, yes. Yep. So I don't know that people want to go to the government to get assistance to take down the government's criminal activities, you know?
Well, they're obviously not common law attorneys.
absolutely not. And they choke on the common law. Okay, any other questions?
No, well, this one had kind of a last shot. Is there anything else I could do to help myself in this process or other resources?
Well, yeah, there's tons of resources right here at NationalLibertyAlliance.org underneath our educational tab. We have even information on how to gain access into the courts and court forms, process, and instructions, for instance, right here. I'm sharing it on the screen. And it gives a lot of information on how to access into the court, instruction forms, challenging jurisdictions, show causes, notice of motions. I mean, all of the basic information you need to work yourself through the court system. Then there is, Gerard, what was the name of that course we took, that lawyer? I don't know if you remember. What was that? Anyway, we took a course some years ago, but it's a lawyer.
Jurisdictionary?
Yeah, jurisdictionary. So what is it, jurisdictionary.com maybe or something? Which is probably, if you put jurisdictionary.
I mean, if you Google jurisdictionary, it'll come up. It's pretty popular now.
Yeah, so I mean, you can go in there. This guy gives you a course, and he's really good for giving you the structure. He does try to be constitutional and common law-ish, but clearly he doesn't really understand because he's too bar focused, and his mind has been really tainted pretty bad. But he seems to have found some freedom, and so. But the key thing with this guy is he teaches you the process, the procedures, the forms, the structure. Okay, so it's another place to get information. But you have to go back into the common law to deal with the content of your paperwork and not necessarily deal with the content or some of the ideas on how to approach the system or people. You want to focus in on common law when you build your case. And that you can find tons and tons and tons of things on National Liberty Alliance. If you go to our tab, Grand Jury, highlight Grand Jury. By the way, you can see our action against YouTube up here. That was the other one, YouTube. But we have action against the judiciary. So if you click on action against the judiciary, we have a huge amount of information because we filed a lot of papers, a lot of memorandums, and you can go through this stuff and kind of copy and use the basic format and structure and curtail it around the case that you have, depending. I mean, this is really focuses in on subversion particularly. But our memorandums that we have up here, and we've got quite a few of them, these memorandums, you know, can be used in all kinds of ways, depending on what kind of a battle you're making in the court. Or if you're trying to do a habeas corpus, you can take a look at the habeas corpuses and see how we put it together. There's like three or four processes to go through the habeas corpus. There should be only one, but if they reject and deny and don't go forward, then there's other processes you got to go forward with on that stuff. And all that paperwork is there to be, just use that as a framework and put in your own words inside of it. And that's pretty much it. You know, a lot of court stuff is all forms. And we've created our own forms. We've created common law forms. We try to be as close as we can to the civil process so it's recognizable to them, but very careful not to put ourselves into a statutory position or process. Okay, is that the last question, Jan?
Yes.
Hey, John?
One.
I just want to say one thing about this business of suing them for firing you from your job. And I don't care if it's a government job or a private sector job. They're all on thin ice and they know it. First of all, there is no mandate. It was a press release. There is no executive order on file. These guys are running with smoke and mirrors. It's very important that everybody that faces this enters a lawsuit in. Everybody should have a lawsuit going, and you should sue them personally, and they're liable. And the employers are going to start backing down. Some of them already have, because they're on very, very thin legal ground. Biden purposely didn't register that executive order. It was just a press release, because he's not responsible now. He doesn't have to take responsibility. All these businesses are going to take it on the chin. Look, this thing is an experimental shot. They cannot force you to take it. That's well established under law, under Nuremberg and under many, many numerous other laws. And it's going to be an experimental shot until 2023 at the earliest. So they're just hoping that nobody calls their bluff. But if everybody files lawsuits, they're going to cave. The business, they cannot uphold to it, because the law is not on their side. Even the liberal judges can't uphold it. And there's enough patriots out there and patriot sites, and there's plenty of people doing. There's lawyers doing class actions and not even class action, but like what we did, where you just join in. And they're doing them pro bono. So I think this thing is going to crash in another month or so. I don't see it holding up much longer, but I think it's very important that people, whether they get a lawyer or whether they learn how to write the papers through jurisdictionary, that they register a lawsuit against them, because it's definitely not going to hold up in court, and you're definitely going to win. As far as I can't see them wiggling out, you know, any other way, you know. And the government's not going to save those businesses, because that's just that evil cabal. They'll use you and throw you under the bus, and that's exactly what's going to happen. So I wouldn't discourage anybody from filing a suit, because I think this is the easiest case to win right now. You got 50% of the country screaming and on your side. And then you got even another percentage that took the shot and got ill or somebody died. I think it's 60% or maybe even 70% of the country that is now against these shots and these mandates. So right now is a very good time to push back. If there ever, and this is the issue to push back on. Okay, so that's my 2 cents. Don't ever quit your job, though.
Well, like 3 cents.
But don't ever quit. Make them fire you, because that helps your lawsuit. Plus, it helps your, you know, they're not going to want to give you unemployment. They got lots of different planes that they're going to lose on here. Okay.
Okay, and with all that said, you know, we've got plenty of places you can learn a lot of things that we've laid out. You know, we still are doing, the only involvement we're doing with cases particularly really is non-judicial foreclosures. We set that up, and also habeas corpuses. So anybody that needs to deal with those two particular problems, we may be able to assist you. But we don't win too often. As a matter of fact, we only won a few times on that, and we've had lots of cases, probably hundreds of cases between them easily. And but the thing is it still goes into, it still gets filed up into our federal case and connected to that, and it will be dealt with, all of the non-judicial foreclosures and the resistance to the habeas corpuses and all of the necessary indictments we did on federal judges and even some state judges. All up there in our court case, and when we get to the other side, we expect to execute them and people to be compensated for that. But, you know, the plan is a very interesting plan. I think that's going forward, and I don't know that I know it, but I suspect I have some good ideas on some of the things, and maybe one Monday we'll focus in on that kind of thinking, and because it's going to be really, really a boom time for the people at some point in time. But there's going to be a time of real struggle before that. And we're already seeing it, you know. Goodness, I heard today on the news that I think it was out west, but there's some states that are paying as much as $7 or $8 a gallon for gas. I mean, wow. And we're supposed to be you know, really an exporter, and he shut the pipelines down. He shut the trucking down. That's why we're not getting a lot of supplies, and the stores are, you know, becoming bare because they're putting in all kinds of things to restrict the movements of trucks through codes and statutes or some kind of legislation, which, and I'm sure other things too. But anyway, let's get back on program here. All right. By the way, Gerard, I'm going to go forward on a subject. I'll pass things over to you if you're going to be here after I finish. And I'm going to take some questions very specifically on the subject matter tonight. It's about 25 minutes long. I'm going to do a PowerPoint. And we can now do a PowerPoint right off the computer, which is really nice. If this thing isn't coming through and people aren't hearing the voice, Jan, get my attention if there's something wrong with it. But you and I tested this the other day, and it was working good. So yep. It should work tonight for us. So, and I'm really excited about that, because I'd like to do PowerPoints in order to bring instruction, and it's much better. I can work at it a lot better than reading, you know, a long paper, and also give some visual as we're going through it. So let's take a look at that, and we'll take questions that anybody might have on this subject matter, and then after that we'll move over to Brent if he's here, and then into open forum, and if Brent isn't here, then we'll move right into open forum. By the way, has anyone seen Brent yet tonight?
Not me.
No, he hasn't gotten here yet.
Okay, keep an eye on him and let me know. Okay, so we did do this subject before. I do believe we uploaded a PowerPoint video, and it was very distorted, didn't come out too well, if I recall. I mean, I couldn't tell from my end, but I was told this by many people, so it was really kind of horrible. But again, because of what's going on in the news today concerning the ignorance of slavery and American history, I felt it necessary that we should do this tonight. So let's do this, and then we'll take our questions and comments on this subject matter alone before we move into the broad spectrum of the subjects. So here we go. Our founding fathers and slavery in America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men... are created equal. Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. The United States of America was built upon liberty for all. For centuries, slavery had been growing part of the economy worldwide. In North America, slavery was established somewhere in the 1500s. Our founding fathers, prior to the creation of the United States of America, were born and lived under British rule, which promoted slavery in the colonies at the time of the Revolution. In 1729, Benjamin Franklin became the owner and publisher of a colonial newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, and through public discourse initiated by Benjamin Franklin, motivated the national narrative concerning the abuse of King George of Britain. Originally, the dialogue was to expose and repair the problems of the colonial relationship with Britain, which eventually turned into the Declaration of Independence from Britain. Amongst the discussions for the creation of this new nation, the United States of America, was the issue to end slavery, led by Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, which declared, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Jefferson thereby changed the national narrative to enlightenment, and a government by consent of the people, and that all men are created equal. This discourse led to self-examination of themselves in their pursuit of their own liberty from their abusive king, which led our founding fathers to the conclusion that the norm of slavery that they were born under was evil. As chairman of the committee that drafted the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote a paragraph condemning slavery in his first draft of the Declaration. He included this paragraph in his list of complaints against King George III. Before the final version of the Declaration was adopted, the following paragraph was deleted because many believed it was too early to take such a bold stand and would threaten the union of the colonies. Jefferson had written, "He, King George III, has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life, liberty, in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating, carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the infamy of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to forbid or to restrain this execrable commerce." Jefferson went on to call the institution of slavery an abominable commerce and an assemblage of horrors. He then criticized the Crown for exciting those very people to rise in arms amongst us and to purchase that liberty
of which he has deprived them by murdering the people on whom he also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with the crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. Like many of his contemporaries in Virginia, Jefferson held benevolent views of his slaves, feeling responsible for their welfare while doubting their ability to succeed in a free white world. Jefferson had strong scruples against selling slaves, saying, "While freeing persons whose habits have been formed in slavery is like abandoning children, my opinion has ever been that until more can be done for them, we should endeavor, with those whom fortune has thrown on our hands, to feed and clothe them well, protect them from ill usage, require such reasonable labor only as is performed voluntarily by freemen, and be led by no repugnancies to abdicate them and our duties to them. Nothing would induce me to put my Negroes out of my protection." Jefferson's character had to be destroyed in order for the New World Order, that was already entrenched in the creation of our government as early as 1776, to take a foothold. By 1792, Hamilton, who had already had strong ties to the foreign bankers, was already advocating for a national bank, at which time Jefferson saw Hamilton as a threat to liberty. Jefferson knew that a central bank would destroy America. Jefferson knew the diabolical plan to destroy a republic when he said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issues of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around these banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on a continent their fathers conquered." The first act of Jefferson's political career was to attempt to make it legal for slave owners in Virginia to emancipate their slaves. That bill was rejected, as was the condemnation of slavery in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence. His labor in this cause finally met with some success in 1778, when he introduced a bill in the Virginia House of Delegates to prevent the further importation of slaves into the state. The proposal was approved, but he recognized that it was only stopped the increase of the evil by importation, leaving to future efforts its final eradication. It was Jefferson's desire to open the way for his final eradication. The very next year, when his committee submitted their proposal for the revision of Virginia's legal code, however, he ascertained through conversations with his colleagues that the legislature was not yet prepared to consider such a progressive step, so he calculated another strategy. The bill on the subject of slaves was a mere digest of the existing laws respecting them. Without any intimidation of the plan for the future and general emancipation, it was thought better that this should be kept back and attempted only by way of amendment whenever of the bill should be brought on. But when the bill did come up for debate, Jefferson was unable to get his amendment passed, after which he wrote, "It was found that the public mind would not yet bear the proposition. Yet the day is not distant when it must bear and adopt it, or worse will follow. Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free." Jefferson would be heard from again on the issue of slavery. The vast area between the Appalachians and the Mississippi had long been claimed by several of the original states, but the recent cession of these claims placed the area under the control of Congress. In early 1784, Jefferson was appointed chairman of the committee to settle the many land disputes which had risen and to prepare a plan for the government of his western of this western region. Jefferson himself drafted the report, known to history as the Ordinance of 1784. According to one scholar, the plan ranks second in importance only to the Declaration of Independence among Jefferson's state papers. This document, which reprinted together with preliminary drafts, became the basis for the famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787. It provided for the creation of self-governing territories that would eventually be admitted to the Union on terms of full equality with the original states. It was a bold and brilliant concept, one that would ultimately have a tremendous influence on the westward expansion of the United States. But Congress rejected a very significant element in Jefferson's report on the Western territories. He had included in his bill a clause barring slavery in any of these territories after the year 1800, a measure which might have averted the Civil War, but this proposal was defeated by one vote, as Jefferson lamented. The voice of a single individual would have prevented this abominable crime from spreading itself over the new country. Thus we see the fate of millions unborn hanging on the tongue of one man, and heaven was silenced in that awful moment. But it is to be hoped it will not always be silent, and that the friends to the rights of human nature will in the end prevail. In 1782, Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events, and that it may become probable by supernatural interference, the Almighty has no attributes which can take sides with us in such a contest." Jefferson worried about what might have to take place before this victory for the rights of human nature could be secured. Jefferson had actually advocated this idea 8 years earlier. He proposed the New Virginia Constitution, containing a provision that any future colonies established from Virginia Western Domain would be free and independent of this colony and of all the world. Always an optimist, in the end, however, Jefferson noted the next year that the cause of emancipation was gaining daily recruits from the influx into the office of young men grown and growing up. These have sucked in the principles of liberty, as it were, with their mother's milk, and it is to them I look with anxiety to turn the fate of this question. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in the early 1790s championed republicanism, which is rule by law and not men. Jefferson began his presidency with a plea for reconciliation, stating, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." Jefferson had no plans for a two-party system of government. He also began with a strong commitment to limited government and strict construction of the Constitution. All these commitments were soon to be tested by the exigencies of war, diplomacy, and political contingency. It is important to take into account that slavery was a norm of the 18th century. Like many citizens of his time, Benjamin Franklin owned slaves from as early as 1735 until 1781, and viewed them as inferior to white Europeans, as it was believed they could not be educated. After 1758, Franklin gradually changed his mind when his friend Samuel Johnson brought him to one of Dr. Bray's schools for black children. Dr. Bray's Associates was a philanthropic association affiliated to the Church of England. In 1759, Franklin met with Anthony Benezet, who started a school in Philadelphia and who later co-founded the Abolition Society. In 1763, Franklin wrote that African shortcomings and ignorance were not inherently natural, but came from lack of education, slavery, and negative environments. He also wrote that he saw no difference in learning between African and white children. After the American Revolution, many colonists, particularly in the North, where slavery was relatively unimportant to the agricultural economy, began to link the oppression of the enslaved African to their own oppression by the British, and to call for slavery's abolition. What Abraham Lincoln said about our founders and slavery. The founding fathers, said Lincoln, had opposed slavery. They adopted a Declaration of Independence that pronounced all men created equal. They enacted the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, banning slavery from the vast Northwest territories. To be sure, many of the founders owned slaves, but they asserted their hostility to slavery in principle while tolerating it temporarily in practice. That is why they did not mention the word slavery or slave in the Constitution, but referred only to persons held to service. Thus, the thing is hid away in the Constitution, said Lincoln. Just as an afflicted man hides away a wen or a cancer, which he dares not cut out at once, lest he bleed to death, with the promise, nevertheless, that the cutting away may begin at the end of a given time, the first step was to prevent the spread of this cancer, which the fathers took with the Northwest Ordinance, the prohibition of the African slave trade in 1807, and the Missouri Compromise restriction of 1820. The second was to begin a process of gradual emancipation, which the generation of the fathers had accomplished in the states north of Maryland. Lincoln continued, in 1794, they forbidden an ongoing slave trade, that is, the taking of slaves from the United States to sell. In 1798, they forbidden the bringing of slaves from Africa into the Mississippi Territory, this territory then comprising what are now the states of Mississippi and Alabama. This was 10 years before they had the authority to do the same thing as to the states existing at the adoption of the Constitution. In 1800, they forbidden American citizens from trading in slaves between foreign countries, as for instances from Africa to Brazil. In 1803, they passed a law in aid of one of the two state laws in restraint of the internal slave trade. In 1807, in an apparent hot haste, they passed a law nearly a year in advance to take effect the first day of 1808, the very first day the Constitution would permit, forbidding the African slave trade by heavy pecuniary and corporal penalties. In 1820, finding these provisions ineffectual, they declared the trade piracy and annexed it to the extreme penalty of death. While all this was passing in the general government, five or six of the original slave states had adoption systems of gradual emancipation, and by which the institution was rapidly becoming extinct within these limits. Thus we see the plain, unmistakable spirit of that age toward slavery was hostility to the principle and toleration only by necessity. In Lincoln's famous 1860 Cooper Union speech, he noted that of the 39 framers of the Constitution, 22 had voted on the question of banning slavery in the new territories. 20 of the 22 voted to ban it, while another one of the Constitution's framers, George Washington, signed it into law, legislation enforcing the Northwest Ordinance that banned slavery in the Northwest Territory. At Cooper Union, Lincoln also quoted Thomas Jefferson, who had argued in favor of Virginia's emancipation. it is still in our power to direct the process of emancipation and deportation peaceably and in such slow degree as that the evil will wear off insensibly. To be sure, the Founding Fathers weren't abolitionists. They were overwhelmingly anti-slavery. Before we judge too harshly, we must understand that slavery was established long before the Revolutionary War. There isn't a specific date, of course, but it grew from there. Our Founding Fathers were born into a world whose economy relied on slave labor from cotton, tobacco, and sugarcane plantations, even to local businesses. Some believe that since slavery was so commonplace, growing a conscience about it might easily not have happened at all. They suggested that the fact that they had opposed slavery at all was incredibly radical for their time. They did, in fact, grow conscience. By the quotes, letters, and documents they left behind, it is clear that our Founding Fathers wished to see slavery ended, though they did not believe it possible for it to happen in their lifetime. Some of them, most notably Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, were very supportive of the rapidly growing abolitionist movement. Benjamin Franklin was president of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, which included Jay and Hamilton. The year he died, he signed a petition for the abolition of all slavery. He died before he got to see it to become a reality. John Jay, as governor of New York, made numerous efforts to push anti-slavery laws. He founded the New York State's Society for Promoting the Manumission of Slaves and New York's African Free School, which taught free slaves reading, writing, and basic arithmetic. Hamilton grew up with a deep-rooted hatred of the slave trade that fueled his work as an avid supporter of the abolitionist his entire life. As the Founding Fathers' public attitude toward slavery suggests that they were not cruel slave owners nor mistreated those beneath them. Even James Madison, who never made any public anti-slavery efforts, is quoted as telling his overseers to be kind and compassionate to his slaves. Benjamin Franklin taught his slaves to read and write and cared very much for some of them. A British abolitionist wrote a letter to James Madison asking many questions about slavery that gives a picture of how Madison viewed slavery and what the prevalent beliefs about slavery were at the time. According to Madison, it was not uncommon for slave owners to get attached to their slaves. The smaller the household, the more this seemed to be true, especially of our Founding Fathers. In letters from these men, to and from their wives, they recall many stories about their personal slaves, ask about their well-being, and in more than one case, they requested in their wills that those closest to them be freed at their deaths. None of the Founding Fathers lived to see the legal abolition of slavery, though by the time they died, they had contributed towards preparing the gradual act for the abolition of slavery. Patrick Henry, who is most famous for his quote, "Give me liberty or give me death," wrote in a letter, "I am drawn along by a general inconvenience of living without them. I will not, I cannot justify it, however culpable my conduct." When George Washington's father, Augustine, died in 1743, George Washington became a slave owner at the early age of 11. Despite having been an active slave holder for 56 years, George Washington struggled with the institution of slavery and spoke frequently of his desire to end the practice. Washington wrote to a friend and said, "I can only say that there is not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of slavery." Patrick Henry wrote, It is not a little surprising that Christianity should encourage a practice so totally repugnant to the first impressions of right and wrong. James Madison, in a letter to his father, told a story about his slave who was traveling with him. He concluded that he would have to sell the slave, though I do not expect to get near the worth of him, but cannot think of punishing him by transportation merely for converting that liberty for which he have paid the price of so much blood, and have proclaimed so often to be the right and worthy the pursuit of every human being. George Madison, called the father of the Bill of Rights, said in his address to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, "As much as I value a union of all states, I would not admit the southern states into the union unless they agreed to the discontinuance of this disgraceful trade, because it would bring weakness, not strength, to the union. And the argumentation of slaves weakens the states, and such a trade is diabolical in itself and disgraceful to mankind." Okay, that brings us to the end of that particular PowerPoint. And I see we do have some people in the queue, and I only want to address questions, comments, or corrections concerning this. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. How is it that Jefferson is claimed to be a contradiction, an enigma, and that he was a slave owner, a terrible person, when history clearly teaches differently? And this ignorance has grown throughout our entire nation. I mean, even Donald Trump doesn't even recognize or realize this. You know, we covered this, by the way, in the book, and we have been trying to get a copy of the book to the President Trump. It was returned to us, and we're going to try another way to get a copy to him. And I know he does read a lot, so hopefully he'll read our book, and he will read about this as slavery, and hopefully articulate it sometime in the future. but people think we're a democracy when, in fact, we're a republic. A democracy is repugnant to our process. Our founding fathers found it repugnant, and we are not a democracy. It may be true that we select our representatives in a democratic fashion, which of course seems to make sense, but our nation is a republic. We're a people of law. We're not governed by these legislators at all. We govern ourselves, and we've given the power and the authority of our government to govern itself through legislation, and that's the purpose of the 57 U.S. Codes that are written, you know, by our Congress. But okay, so let's take some questions, comments, and thoughts. So we got Heather. We'll take Heather first. You got the mic, Heather. Heather Lee.
Yes, Don. Question I have. I actually have two, but. The first one quickly is concerning the Northwest Ordinance, which is inclusive of land patents. And the question is, upcomingly, as the Constitution, common law comes into effect, okay, with that, the land tax is such a travesty on the people. And at this point in time, with people losing their businesses, and such, they're losing their homes too. And the land tax is arduous. It is a ball and chain that has been put on the people. And of course, the land is the people, we the people. And they have stolen, you know, from us as we the people in our land by taking our very, the very sustenance of our life, the land that we live on, and taking that for their own use. That's how Bill Gates got so much farmland, by that farm scandal in the 80s. That was the major theft of the farmland of the United States. Anyway, these counties seem to be able to, while you're sleeping, increase with these unlawful assessors, these assessors in treason, to as accomplices to the county treasurers and their capper accounts for retirement and such. Now, what do you think when the Constitution does come back? I'm not hearing a terrible outcry, except for doing the cases with Jim here at National Liberty Alliance against the mortgages and foreclosures. But I'm not hearing people really, they're so occupied with the experimental vax that, you know, these people at the very same time are losing everything they have. They're going to be homeless. They're going to be living under bridges and on the street. What do you have to say about that in particular? How do you think that is that going to be addressed? I mean, as soon as the Constitution comes back, we already have it. It's already into play, but they're still acting under the color of law like they have been. And we know that the corporates are dead. We know the USA corporate is dead. We know that the courts in Admiralty is dead, but they're still acting out that same system. And I have a second part to this question, so I just want to hear what you have to say briefly. That's going to go.
We do see how it is heading and where it's intended to be and bring us into total bankruptcy and thereby enslave us and give up our Constitution and go on and on and on and on, because they're moving in order to bring us into Marxism, Communism, Nazism, whatever ism you want to say, but the New World Order is intended on taking control of everything. I mean, they pretty much control probably at least 80% of the worth of the world. And they continue to go on and on and on. It's never enough for them. This continues and goes forward because of the municipalities, because county, we're into corporatism. Corporatism is synonymous with Nazism. It's all part of the process. And that's why we see the president telling all these corporations, you know, hey, you know, you punish the people. Fire them or whatever, you know, all these different things and ideas he would like to see in order to suppress the people and cause problems. And this problem is really serious, but there's a whole bunch of other problems. We see a lot of things collapsing. The economy is really collapsing to some degree. The inflation is out of hand. Price of fuel has gone up. I mean, we got plenty of oil. You shut down the oil pipelines coming down in. We're no longer, you know, totally independent. We were independent. We didn't have to export oil or anything. Prices were going down until Trump left office, and of course they reversed. It's a very serious problem. Where do I see it going to? I see a whole different thing. First of all, you know, I've heard talk. I didn't think it was possible, and I'm very familiar with the Jubilee out of the Bible. And many people thought, well, that's what we got to get to is the Jubilee. Well, that is common law, and that's the only solution to the problem. There is the National Economic Security and Reformation Act for global peace, freedom, and prosperity. Now, this is claimed to have passed, and I can't find that it has passed, so I don't know. But I'm going to read little parts of this because this is the way it has to be. There can be no other way. Look, the plan of the New World Order was to bankrupt us, to bring us into debt and say, now you got to pay that debt back. And it can never be paid back, not in our lifetime or our children's lifetime. And by that time, America won't even be remembered anymore. The Constitution would be gone, and liberty and the heritage of the people on this continent would be lost. Okay, and that's their plan. That's their plan. And suppress and kill, torture, whatever they got to do, anyone who rebels against that. But this idea that they put together, again, it was claimed that a law was passed in the United States in March 2000 and signed into law in October of 2000. This law is called the National Economic Security and Reformation Act, all politicians and media members are under a gag order not to speak of it publicly until it is officially announced. This new law will be enacted in the United States and eventually will be rolled out across the world. The law provides, and I want to read a couple of these things that it provides for, but I want to say one thing. I have not been able to show proof that this has actually passed. Someone's claiming this, but show me where. I haven't seen it.
Is that Nassara?
Yeah, Nassara. Yes, let me finish, though. If you want to comment on it, that's fine, but let me finish. So I can't find anything to prove that that's a fact. And I also heard from somebody recently that the military put Congress at gunpoint, so to speak, maybe literally, maybe not literally, I don't know, in order to pass this through. I find that difficult to believe, but again, and there's no way, I have seen no evidence. So again, I can't find the evidence. And I want to get back to the contents of this thing, the conclusion. It brings in Jubilee. You see, the opposite side of the coin here, when Trump finishes doing what he's got to do, the best is yet to come, and returns the gold and the silver back to the people and all the property, and 80% of the world's wealth that's being held by these evil SOBs, they're taking it away from them. What are they going to do with it? What's Trump going to do with it? What's the people that are doing this going to do with it? Are they going to keep it for themselves? Are they going to give it to government? Of course not. They've got to give it back to the people. We, the people, have been robbed. So that's why there's going to be one heck of a boom, an explosion of economic success and growth like never seen before once we get to the other side, for the best is yet to come. Now, here's some of the things that was written. And this has to be, because, you know, look at credit cards are a problem. That's a ripoff, 19%, 18%, unbelievable. You want to talk about usury? That's usury, okay? And this is all going to, you know, all these big corporations that are all part of the game, you know? So forgiveness of credit cards, mortgage, student loans, and other bank debts to illegal banking and governing activities. Absolutely, that's got to happen. There's no getting away from it. Otherwise, the people need to rebel against the people who are trying to free them once we get control of the courts. We, the people, need to bring it to this point if they don't. But I do believe this is all part of Trump's plan. Okay? Dissolve the IRS and end all income tax. That's got to be. The 16th Amendment is repugnant to the Constitution, and it never truly passed anyway. It was passed by a handful of men and never ratified. I've got plenty of paperwork showing the fact that it never was ratified. I got proof of that it's never ratified. Same thing with the 17th Amendment. Create fiat rate non-essential new items only. Sales tax for food, medicine, and all other items will not be taxed. Well, I'm not sure exactly. Create flat rate non-essential new items only sales tax. Okay, sales tax is a legal tax, and definitely you cannot tax food, medicine, and clothes. You can't tax that. I know here in New York they tax clothes, and it shouldn't be. I know Pennsylvania doesn't tax clothes, okay? This bag tax that the governor put onto the people in this grocery stores where you got to pay 5 cents, that's a tax onto the people. That's unlawful. It's repugnant. It cannot be. People's property. If you have to pay a tax and you don't pay that tax on a yearly basis and they take it away from you, you're just renting it. You don't own it. Of course, the land tax is a direct tax onto the people. You cannot do it. Only indirect taxes can be applied. And therefore, you cannot be taxed directly. So income tax, unlawful, illegal, unconstitutional. The Constitution is clear concerning direct tax. Okay. Increased benefits to senior citizens. Okay, that makes sense. Returns constitutional law to all courts and legal matters. Retains all judges and attorneys in constitutional law. Look at the Bar Association must be destroyed, dismantled, and just destroyed. Blown to the winds, the four winds. I mean, just gone. The Bar Association must cease to exist. We do need a proper education for lawyers for the purpose of equity, okay? But this whole system that they created, the Bar Association, has created an army of minions of the New World Order to bring us into statutory prisons through civil law, Babylonian law, and to destroy the Constitution as they did in 1934 through the Rules Enabling Act. Empowering, where the United States Supreme Court, where the Congress empowered the United States Supreme Court, vested them with power, and they have no power to vest anyone with power, and they didn't even have any power to give that power away. They themselves didn't possess that power in order to destroy our courts by getting rid of the rules of the common law and replace them with the rules of destruction, ultimately. Let's see, what else? End the Federal Reserve System, no-brainer, got to go. Create new treasury currency backed by gold and silver, absolutely has to happen. Restore financial privacy, has to happen. Get out of our banks and our business. And there's a few other things here. But look at any utility bills, all these things. I mean, we have been robbed. Everything is forgiven. Okay, there is no way to get this nation back on track and to be righteous, okay, other than to free the people of the burden of the debt that these people have laid upon us and destroyed us. You know, I personally should be a millionaire with the business and things that I have been doing over the years, but, you know, I came through the times of learning when things were great, and by the time I got to the point where I really understood how I can make money and do things, I had to grab out for every penny I could get. And, you know, my prices were restricted because inflation was constantly coming up over and over, so it was a struggle. And the people that I learned from, the people that mentored me in the business, all of them at the time when I was being mentored by these elderly individuals, they all had numerous homes, they had boats, they had indoor pools, and I mean, they had a lot of stuff. I mean, it was the business I went into. But, you know, when it came to my turn, you know, inflation just killed us over and over again from the 80s, the 90s, right into the 2000s. I mean, it's just destructive, okay? But look at all debt has got to be forgiven because it's all fraud to begin with. All mortgages got to be forgiven. For there is no contract on a mortgage, and the banks have no business trying to collect the mortgage or take people's property because they failed to pay the mortgage. All that is unlawful and unconstitutional. So that debt has to be forgiven. If you own a home at a certain point, whatever mortgage, it's going to be gone. It's got to. Okay, the Federal Reserve is a fraud and everything they've done. And think of all the interest that they have charged on people. You want to talk about usury again? Okay, the compounded interest involved in that. So I see the only solution is the biblical principle of Jubilee. We are a nation, you know, created under the Bible, particularly focused in, well, the whole Bible, of course, but the structure and everything from the first five books of the Bible. And Jubilee is part of the Bible, and it is the solution for a situation like this. So that's where I think we're going to head up, and I think that's where we're going to be. Let me just say one thing. If that does not happen, and if the people step up and take control of their local government through committees of safety, and you get every county gets a couple of hundred people together, then we will seize control of every county. The people will seize control of their own government. And we collectively, we can force and make this happen. But only, when the people step up to have government by consent. Go ahead, Heatherly.
Okay, the second part of this question is in conjunction with that. Sheriff Darleaf, I've been talking with him, and we had a really good conversation the other day, and the thing we were talking about was he asked me, he said, and it was brought up in the in Brent Allen Winter's discussion there for the course on the American Sheriff of Common Law,
mm-hmm.
and which is on Thursday. I'll do a little punch on that one, a little advertisement on Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. Anyway, I called Dar afterward, Sheriff Dar, and we had a real long discussion because I did not realize, and it was brought up, that the sheriff has the right to call the common law grand jury. Now, if this be so, then the common law grand jury doesn't have to be called by the administrator necessarily. Let me correct
that one point. It's not the administrator that calls for the grand jury. Okay, it's got to be the sheriff. The sheriff is the one who calls for the grand jury. The administrator
every time
provides it. Okay, and the administrators can investigate on behalf of the grand jury and bring evidence to an existing grand jury of any kind of a situation that they think the grand jury should take a look at. But we got to be careful. If it's a criminal thing, okay, it's the sheriff that must take it to the grand jury. It's either the sheriff or the coroner. No U.S. attorney, no other attorney, nobody can take criminal cases to the grand jury but the sheriff or the coroner. That's
excellent.
Common law.
Excellent. Because Sheriff Dar wanted to, the point being is in Michigan, he has that control. He has a good handle on the Constitution in common law, and he wants to call a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is something that Robert Overhuel and myself and him were kind of working on.
Yeah, I was involved a little bit in the background of some of that discussion, and my advice was that he shouldn't go forward with it at that point in time until he builds up more sheriffs behind him and organizes better. I thought it would be too dangerous for him. That was my opinion. I didn't speak directly to Dar about this, but I did speak with, I think it was Overhuel, I'm sure I spoke with him. And maybe I forget who else was involved. But
that was my thought also.
It was just too early. Is he thinking about doing it now?
Well, what he's looking at, and it's prime time, is the election. Because he has control in his county to do something, to step up. And because Antrim County, where I live, has stepped up, and now DiPerno is running for AG in Michigan, and we've got a constitutional man, Garrett Soldano, running for the governor, okay? And because these sheriffs have now rallied, they've changed their tune. They got rid of the stinker. You know, the cabal had come in and tried to cause trouble with the sheriff. And these 83 sheriffs have now turned the corner and gotten into Sheriff Dar's corner again. And now they're seeing the light of day because they're seeing what's going on, and they're waking up.
You said 83?
And so now he wants to go forward.
Excuse me.
And call for a grand jury in his county and have the first hearing, if you will, an investigation and hearing on the voting procedure. And he could set a precedent in Michigan and start the fire with the rest of these. I mean, there's several. There's five in my neighborhood that are constitutional at least. There's one in Alpena, there's one in Montcalm County, there's one in Baraga County, clear up in the Upper Peninsula, that I know of, but I know that there's many more in between that are kind of just riding the fence a little bit there because they're still corporately paid, but they see that the Constitution could very well come back, and if Sheriff Dar institutes this and goes forward and actually puts into play the Constitution that he has a right to do, and the people have a right to be as the common law grand jury, it may set a fire across the United States.
Did you say that he's got 82, all 82 of his sheriffs on board with him on this?
There are 83 in the Sheriff's Association. There are 83 counties in Michigan.
Right.
And the lion's share of those sheriffs are on his side.
Maybe I was talking the same time you were. Are you saying that he's got 82 sheriffs in Michigan that is behind him on these issues?
I am saying for part of the 83 that are in Michigan, the lion's share of the 83 sheriffs are in his court.
Okay,
and
so
a lot of them, if he did something like this, would stand behind him.
Lion's share, meaning at least half or more than half of the sheriffs are with him?
I would say so.
Okay, because if that is the case, I would then advise him that he should go forward with grand juries. He should start calling them. He's got the power and the authority to call them right off. He can pull people right off the streets. He can do whatever he wants. He can make phone calls, and he can tell these people to be down at the court at a certain time, a certain day, and he can go down there and let the clerk know we're taking the room because I just called the grand jury. We got business to do, and take them and go. And anybody that gets in his way, he should arrest them. But he's got to have people behind him. He's got to have sheriffs. I mean, half the sheriffs of the state is a huge, huge amount of power. He could accomplish that goal. They can all do that. If they were to do something like that in Michigan, that would spread like wildfire across the entire
state.
It would wake up the sheriff's nation. And that, let me just say this again and take the opportunity to make this point. That is exactly why our campaign for constitutional sheriffs is so important. Anybody out there that's got deep pockets, you need to support this particular project that we got going. We have to get the books into the hands of sheriffs, because once these sheriffs get these books and they start to read through these books, I got to believe they're not going to be able to put this book down. And once they get through that and they see something like this going on in Michigan, it's going to be the sheriffs will save this nation. The sheriffs
This is what I told him, that it would set a precedent, and if we could actually, you know, do this with prayer. Some things only come by prayer and fasting, but they have to have action with their faith. It would probably push over states like Florida, who has the sheriff Walter Ivey, who has a boatload of constitutional sheriffs in Florida. Mm-hmm. And if they saw somebody take that step, that first step, that initial step, and they actually put into action what the Constitution gives them the right to do, and they actually did it and not just talked about it, I think sheriffs all over the country, especially because Sheriff Mack, with his association, is growing stronger every day in reaching all these sheriffs and educating them, I think the sheriffs will finally rise out of the dust and do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that conclusion. And they have an excellent counselor in Brent Winters there, so they can rest and rely on him to assist them with any kind of paperwork or procedure necessary to go through that process. And, of course, they have us at National Liberty Alliance, but Brent is much more capable of really working that process out with them. So, yeah, I hope that's true, and I hope that works out. I'd like to hear more about that. So.
Yeah.
Okay, let me go to the next caller, because you've been
watching
that other people.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take a couple more calls, and I'm going to pass things over to Gerard. Did Brent get in here, by the way? We'll take on, David from New York. You got the mic. Go right ahead, David. David, New York, 718, you got the mic. David from New York going twice, 718. David from New York going three times, 718, you got the mic. Okay, Wilmington, North Carolina, 910 area code, you got the mic. First name, from North Carolina. Nine-one-zero, North Carolina. Can you hear me? You got the mic. I guess we put them to sleep, Heather. Okay, last caller in the box, and then we'll move over to Gerard. Ross, go ahead, Ross. You got the mic.
I'm wondering, I just called my public safety training center today, and my mom just told me I need to start thinking how to articulate to the people of Clackamas County why the community of safety is important.
You know, we have a fantastic video. I'm trying to think where it's at. Maybe when I pass the mic over to Gerard, I'll go take a look at it and then just pipe in to let you know where it's at. I'm pretty sure we do have it up on our website. It's a 30-minute PowerPoint video that we put together on the Committee of Safety, the history, where it comes from, how our founding fathers built this nation with the Committee of Safety, and the importance for us, we the people, to follow suit, because it's the only process available to the people. It's a process that can be very, very successful with or without Trump, with or without the military, if all the people were to focus in. You know, again, we don't have government by the majority. We have a government by the majority that participates. You know, each county has, I know my county has 249 committeemen, so generally speaking, you know, a county is controlled by 249 committeemen. Of course, they are controlled slaves. They don't realize that, you know, they're really told what to do, and they're hoodwinked. But nevertheless, that's what it'll take. If we have a couple of hundred people in every county, we could take this nation back literally overnight if the people want to do it. And all they have to do is follow the process of what our founding fathers did, get the sheriff on our side, educate him, and get together. And you can. Then let me tell you, if the sheriff calls out the posse, he's going to get a lot more than the 200 people that are in that county that are active. So he's going to get a lot more than that. So, you know, that is probably something that you're going to want to share with people if you want to share with them the importance of the Committee of Safety. Also, this seminar that I'm doing, it'll be recorded, and we'll break it up in pieces, but the PowerPoint part of this of the conference will be probably maybe 45 minutes at the most, an hour, but I'd like to stay around 45 minutes if I can really lay it out in that limited amount of time. Then that will be posted up, and again, then those, and we'll turn it into a PowerPoint video as well as the conference itself, or the seminar, whatever we call it. And we'll make that all available online as one of the tools. As a matter of fact, I believe the video, matter of fact, I'm sure the video that I'm talking about that introduces you to the Committees of Safety and how our founding fathers structured this and how it was founded, that is one of the videos we suggest to be used at the first meeting when people come together in the Committee of Safety to reveal, you know, the process and why it's so important. And so we've made that available for download. So that should be, let me see real quick, I might be able to know where it's at. It should be under People's Duty, let's see, Committee of Safety maybe, and instruction and video conferences, let's see, maybe it'll be under that. Organizing your County Committee of Safety, okay, that's a video I believe. Okay, that's a Monday night program where we did something, and that's on the committee man. And like I said, we're going to be changing things on that. I'll have to look through here, and maybe I'll pipe in a little while and where exactly these videos are. But they are videos here that are downloadable on that. So that's where I'd go, Ross. I'll try to get that to you.
Yeah, I'm having problem to invite people, because I don't know as many people in Clackamas County to get people to join.
Well, what you need to do is this. This is how it starts. One person has to take the initiative to start, getting organized. And, it starts off with finding one other person that's interested to do it and meet for coffee from time to time, here or there, and, as often as you can. And next thing you know, one brings a friend, you got three people, five people, 10 people. And at some point, when you have that many people, then you say, well, okay, let's get our first Committee of Safety meeting going and introduce it to the people. And you then go to different places, resources where you can get people to come. There's all kinds of liberty groups. All counties have liberty groups, different kind of organizations of interest. You can find patriots. NLA will assist you with people in the surrounding counties and in your county. We'll give you a list and phone numbers of people you can call to invite them. We can also send out mass mailing for you in those areas. to let it be known that you're going to have a committee of safety started up in the county, and anybody who would like to join will learn about it from other counties is welcome, you know, and do what we're doing here in New York. And we'll give plenty of tools to be able to do this. Again, it's all up online and should be under people's duty. I got to go through all of these things to see where exactly we have what, but I know pretty much everything should be under this area here. And of course, we have the handbooks, which is instructional on exactly how to do it. But that's how you start the Committee of Safety. It starts with one person make the decision to do something, takes on the responsibility to put their phone number and their first name up on the website. Just got to fill in that form there. It's very simple. If you're a member, you just got to click a button, and your first name and your phone number goes up there and tells you what state and county. And then that hopefully people will see you and contact you that way, and we'll find many ways to help you get people to come. But that's how you start it. You know, it's called grassroots, and just get it started grassroots-wise. Okay, anything else, Ross? And I want to take the next caller and move on to
July. I was thinking, see, the room I was thinking to borrowing is the event room for that, and it's only fits 50 to 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's only that many people can go in now.
Okay.
Well,
you start off there until you grow big enough, and look at when people come together. Look, you could do these things in libraries. You could do it in town halls. You know, if you're just doing your county, you could do it in town hall. If you're doing multiple counties, then you're going to want to find a place where it may be larger. But unless the town hall is large enough to handle it, you know, where you may have a couple hundred people possibly coming, I mean, you're not going to have that many, but you could. You know, I really don't. Who knows? But, you know, so there's lots of different places you can go to that's free. Those places are all free. The other thing is, for maybe $100 or so, which is what I'm going to do, is rent a conference hall within one of the hotels along the major corridors here up in New York, down in the Poughkeepsie area. And you know, if you rent one of those rooms, and like I'm going to rent one for maybe 30 to 50 people, or let's say 30 people. And if more people comes, you know, that room can grow. And so I would pay, you know, for the size of the room that I finally use at the end of the day. But once you get this going, okay, and you get people coming, you know, there's one of two things you do. You either can take donations every meeting to pay for the necessary overhead costs, or you can charge dues. You know, the group can come together and decide whether they want to do dues or just do donations. So that should help fund you. Also, if you connect to gun clubs or different organizations, there's all kinds of different organizations in every county, and there's usually a gun club. And you approach them and you tell them what you're doing and ask them to work with you, give them a presentation. And they have large areas, large rooms where you'd be able to use those areas, and you give a donation. You know, the people coming together, you take donations and you give a piece of that to the gun club or whatever organization is going to help sponsor the thing to help pay their bills, to keep their lights on and pay the bills for the, you know, the building that you're using and so on. So
I'm wondering, you guys have any contact list of everybody in my county?
We can give you a list of everyone in your county, yes, with their phone numbers and the surrounding counties. If you name the counties, Jan can get that up for you.
Yes, I'll probably, for right now, just do the Clackamas County now.
Yeah, just start, and look, at meet for coffee a few times, and, you know, in the back of, you know, some diner or something, and, you know, just to discuss the ideas before you even have your first real serious meeting where you start to organize and introduce it to the neighborhood, you know. So you want to get as many people as you can organized and come in, and then get as many people as you can to introduce it to. And then that's your first meeting, and then you start your instructional videos as the time goes on. You know, you should have a meeting once a month, bare minimum, okay? But in the beginning, if it's possible, you might want to have it twice a month or as often as possible so you can grow as quick as possible. But you've got subcommittees working on different programs, and, And again, I'm working on this information right now, for, the sub-programs, the sub-committees and their jobs and what's their responsibilities and how each one assists the other and, working those details out. So, all right, Ross, I got to move on, okay?
Okay.
Appreciate it. Okay, Gerard, you want to take the mic? We've got a couple of people that have come into the queue, and I don't know if... I don't think Brent is here. I still don't see him.
I don't see him. I just scanned. I don't see him.
Hey, okay, Mom.
We can work that out if he comes in. But you can take the next caller, and I'll hang out here a little while, too.
Okay. So the next caller is Cora.
You want to share your screen? You want me to bail out of the screen here?
Yeah, I got something I'll probably put up there in a minute.
Okay,
but...
so I'll bail out. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. You can continue as I do that.
Let's see.
Okay, I am no longer screen sharing.
Okay.
I noticed when I was playing the, actually it was a PowerPoint that I was playing. I have the PowerPoint in video form, too. I probably should have done the video because I might have been able to do a little work in the background. When you have the PowerPoint playing and you try to do a little work in the background, as soon as you click onto another program, it pauses it. I didn't know that.
Oh, no kidding.
A couple of times, yeah. So next time I'll do a WMV, window video. And this way, because I got the two screens, I could be doing other things, pulling other information together while I'm projecting that info. But go ahead, Gerard, you got the mic.
Okay, well, I got Cora open. I'm going to pick the screen I want to share while I'm talking to her. Go ahead, Cora.
Hi. A friend told me about this site, so I joined late, and I think you said, maybe you mentioned that you have specific topics, so I might be off topic, so you can hear me and just say, we don't need to discuss that.
Mm-hmm.
But I work at the City and County of San Francisco, and I don't know if you have heard that we had two hearings. First time it was, and again, I'm new to common law, but we had to go back because the reason was procedural. The second time we did was ex parte, and I'm not the lead, but I'm, one of the joinder. So we lost the case for two reasons. First one is the version of petition that was filed was an old version. The old version did not have the detailed explanation of the notice and opportunity process you all followed and how it is, in fact, the due process of law that you are all required to fulfill toward the HR director. So this was not on record, and the judge could claim the director was being deprived of due process because she was not noticed the statutory way. So, and should I continue?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the number two reason was that the statutory application CM-100 was also signed and put on the record at last minute at the behest of the clerk who was supposed to be helping in this case. It is difficult to overcome the presumptions of the court as it is, and this application contracts the petitioner under court policy and rules, whereas the documents were well prepared, were all under common law, and they expressly stipulated that we were coming in under common law and that we were seeking lawful remedy. The CM-100 put the case squarely back in the statutory realm and allowed the judge to make that point at the very start of the meeting. So, we lost that case, and we are regrouping, but we are all learning, and would like to know your opinion of what is the possible step. I heard that...
You're going through exactly what we did in our first cases and hearing the same baloney that we heard when we did our first case, and the judges get in. And they take you to jurisdictions unknown, and they butt in, and they don't uphold common law. And you look at, if you said her due process was being violated, that's the thing that you can take into the federal court because that's their job. You can sanction that judge. We used to come back in and give them a sanction. We used to kind of slap them a little bit, and they didn't like that. It didn't help us win, but we never took the case to federal court. When you're doing a case like that and they cut your due process off and they don't give you your common law, then you can take it to the federal court. The trouble is these federal judges are no better. I mean, every now and then you can win a case because the federal judges are jealous of their power and they will slap a state judge or a lower court. But more often than not, I think one of the things they do is they like to kick it back to the state court saying that you didn't exhaust all your remedies. Like you say, you lost this case. You could have took it to the next court higher. You could have appealed it. And you could go to the Supreme Court anytime you want, but the Supreme Court's going to play a game. If you haven't been kicking around the state court enough, they're going to kick it back because they're lazy and they don't like these hot potatoes anyway. So I would think that they're going to want you to appeal it first, and that's a whole sham. They'll just they'll just steamroll you again, you know, and then after that you remove it to the federal court for cause, and we have plenty of examples of us doing that in our paperwork, you know, on the site. I don't know if you're a paid member. Are you a paid member?
No, this is my first time again to join and hear about this.
Right. Well, if you go look around the site, and we have a lot of resources on our site, we got a lot of drop-down menus that you can use. But if you're not a paid member, you're not going to get all the information. Although you get quite a bit, like you can see our Supreme Court cases and stuff. I don't believe you got to be a paid member to do that. Like if you want to get in to learn how to do the cases and stuff, a lot of that stuff you have to be a $5 a month subscriber.
Okay.
But the site is massive, and you can kind of follow the breadcrumbs through it. But we have lots and lots of stuff, and we also have, you know, like breadcrumbs to bring you along. I mean, we're trying to reestablish common law and the common law grand jury, so that's kind of where our focus is. And we fought them on non-judicial foreclosures and all, you know, where they're taking people's houses and this stuff. And I myself went to court for land tax, you know, they're taking houses in rem, which is an admiralty thing where you get no due process at all. They take the house. It's not against you, it's against the house. It's a bunch of baloney. They convert your deed into the name of the town before they start the process, so it's not your house. So you can't, when they take over the house, they send the sheriff to evict you as a scofflaw tenant. He doesn't even realize that they're foreclosing on a house. They send a thing saying, you got to get this guy out. He's in there illegally. We own the property. So it's really bad in New York State. All right, what state are you in?
California.
California. Well, California is probably the negative is a reflection of New York, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's pretty bad and on either end of the country. I don't know who's worse, New York or California. So
yeah,
either one of those states is an uphill battle, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know what else to tell you as far as that goes. I mean, you're going to end up, if you're going to push it, you're going to have to go through the process. You're going to have to take it to the next higher court. Because like I said, you could go to the federal court, but I almost bet dollars to the donuts, if you've only been in one court, they're going to kick it back and want you to take it at least to an appeals court. And I'm not real familiar with California's courts. I mean, I know how they do it here in the Northeast, but mm-hmm. some of them are a little different than, you know, certain states. And Louisiana, that's a whole different story. They are under some other law, you know, from way back when. So, but, you know, you can play with them. I honestly think that in the next couple of months, things are going to change to the point where you may not have to do all that. So yeah. I don't know. You know, I don't want to tell you don't do it, but in the same token, if we get back to the Constitution, all the stuff John was talking about, it's almost a waste of time to go through and spend money and time and do that if they're going to straighten it out. Look at it. See, I'll tell you right now, it's either going to get very much better or it's going to get very much worse.
Right.
And if it gets worse, you're not going to win anyway. They're never going to let you get through this process because they basically killed our courts. All the judges are compromised, especially up on the higher ends. And even, you know, and not only that, I mean, look, at that county in Arizona, Soros spent $2 million to put that sheriff in. This was over election fraud. He knew that the sheriff could control that. See, they don't know their powers, but George Soros knows the sheriff's power, so much so that he spent $2 million putting this guy in office. So that way he knew he had a guaranteed sheriff that would not interfere with them trying to steal the election. So that's just, you know, that's where we're at. You know, we're on the cusp of some change here. So you may want to wait a month or two to see where we're going as a nation. You know, before you go crazy and spend a lot of time and effort, because it might not be necessary. I mean, of course, if you're in there, there is an advantage to being in there, because those are one of the first cases that will be fixed are the ones that are pending. So I'm not telling you don't file it, you know, but, you know, just kind of pay attention to what's going on to decide, you know, where you want to go and what you want to do. And look at, if this thing straightens out, it could get very much easier for you, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay, I got it. I kind of have that same perspective, but I just want to make sure that I hear every, you know, whatever information I get. And that basically says, hold the line.
Right, exactly.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hang on, I have to stop sharing so I can get back to my web controls here. Just bear with me a minute because I'm on a different screen. Okay, we have Willie McKinley. Willie, what state and...
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me? Hello, I hear you.
You can hear me?
Yes, I can. Loud and clear.
Okay, I'm from Florida.
Okay.
I'm just joining this organization. I'm learning through UR Law, but I'm really interested in really becoming getting involved with the safety committee.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, through the introduction, I spoke to one lady, I forgot her name, and she was giving me the process. But when I went online, I don't see too many people here in Florida that's really actively involved.
Okay, you looked at for your county and see who's around you?
Yes. It looks like they are, but as I say, there is no real information on them.
No, because we don't put a lot out front right away, because a lot of people don't want to be identified. So you really got to call. You got to call, you know, the coordinator that's next to you, and then make connections that way.
Because
not everybody's information is out there in public.
Right.
You know, because you know, look at, let's face it, you're considered a live wire, so you do have to. You know what
yes.
I mean? Not everybody wants their name up there. But what I would do is find out who's in your area and call that coordinator. I mean, you can go out further to the counties and the next county to the state guy, but I'll guarantee you, you'll find somebody closer than that. And if you have to call Jan and ask him to look up, you know, give him your county and your town, and he'll let you know who's, you know, active close to you that you can call, that you can coordinate with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes.
Willie needs to call Jeff Estall. He's the district leader for Florida. He's on the webpage. Give him
okay,
a call.
Okay, he is. Jeff?
Yes. Estall.
Okay.
Estall. His name and number is on the webpage. He's the district leader.
Okay, I can do that. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Good luck. And
yes, sir.
I hope you take off like a rocket. Okay.
It's only one day at a time. That's all I can say.
Yes, right. Okay.
All right. Thank you, sir, and you have a blessed day.
You too. We have an anonymous caller. Is this that anonymous? That's that anonymous that comes on and says, "We are anonymous." Go ahead, Anonymous.
Yes, my name's Scott down here in Georgia.
Okay.
I was just listening to the female that called a little earlier about the court system. You know, people got to realize the court system's been usurped.
Absolutely, we know that. They've been playing. We've been playing with them for years, and we understand that they're all compromised.
Yeah, that, you know, our Constitution talks about our defense against standing armies. And, you know, the American Bar Association, they use these prosecuting generals in these indictments. You know, it's military talk. These generals run around with a standing army police force.
That's a good, I never thought of it as a standing army, but you got a good point.
Yeah. I mean, that's American Bar Association playing both sides of the game here. They're prosecuting and defending, you know, attorneys. You know, you talk about y'all's website having a lot of valuable information. I'll testify to that. One piece of literature I like on y'all's website talks about Justice Scalia. You
know, yes.
I like that old Justice. You know, he defines, you know, probable cause need to be filed within 24 hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, for a speedy trial right now, people getting these tickets and all, you know, there ain't no probable cause being filed properly in the court. So our due process being usurped, too.
There's no such thing as a speedy trial either, especially since COVID came out. They don't even give you a trial, and they don't do it in person. They're violating everything so bad, our forefathers wouldn't even believe it.
Oh, man, they'd be, our forebears would be pissed off with us. We ain't doing that.
They would have had their muskets loaded by now.
Right. But another piece I like was the Justice Scalia court case where it talks about the grand jury.
Yeah, U.S. versus Williams. That's on the landmark Supreme Court cases under the blue bar Supreme Court, and then you go down landmark Supreme Court cases, and yeah, U.S. versus Williams. That's one that everybody should become familiar with because we qualify a lot of our the grand jury's power through the words that Justice Scalia put in that case.
Right on the old man, your grand jury, huh?
of
our free country.
We talk about the sheriffs being able to call a grand jury, and that's a foreign idea to most of these people today. But also, we had another thing where, look at, if there's a grand jury in session, and you have knowledge of a crime going on in your county or whatever, you can actually take it to the grand jury foreman.
Exactly.
That grand jury can investigate that. They don't have to ask the prosecutor or the judge or anybody else. They can do it of their own. Of course, they don't like that because they call that a runaway grand jury. They're scared to death of that.
They've usurped the grand jury.
Yeah.
They are the ones that usurped it.
Yep.
You know, I come across another piece of literature y'all might be interested in. It's a court document with several experts, constitutional experts in it, and they talk about the grand jury. It's a subcommittee record talking about the grand jury and all and the power of it. And within the document, court record, there's a couple experts going on about how the grand jury was the sword and shield. You know?
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't no such thing back in our forebears' days. There wasn't no prosecutors, and there wasn't none of that going on. You know, they usurped the civil law executing power from the militia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a standing army that run around forcing these codes and these masks and stuff on us and whatnot, along with these mandates. With invasion of shots, people need to wake up and start demanding their ye old man your grand jury, and if we got to, you know, we need to call upon the militia, you know, to execute the law of the land, because, you know, prosecuting generals running around here.
Most of what they're subjecting the people to today is all smoke and mirrors. And I believe if everybody stood up and challenged them, they would fall down. Look, a mandate is not a law. A mandate is a suggestion. And it doesn't become a law until you obey it. You obey it and make it a law. If go look up a mandate in Black's Law Dictionary and see the definition of it, it is not a law. They cannot enforce it. When they tell me, get your mask on or I'll call the cops, I tell them, call the cops, please. Because yeah, I'm gonna sue you, and I'm gonna sue anybody that comes in the way of my inalienable rights. And it's not a law.
Coin too.
Yeah. Well,
don't pay me some gold and silver coin.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, you got to know how to play the game, too. And right now they're weak. They're weak. People are pissed. And
I'm fixing to actually file a court case on a big one. I survived a malicious prosecution. And I call it my treaty. Since they want to force me into a contract, you know, I'm going to lay my contract out there now. It's a treaty, you know. I'm looking to set some precedent with it. You know, it's going on 400 pages long now. My pleading itself is just about 50 pages long now. So it's very interesting. And it's all constitutional language and Black's Law Dictionary language.
I'll tell you right now, they don't want to read it. They see something like that, it gets pushed aside. They get it. They're like, oh, this guy is crazy. I'm telling you, because there is no recourse for us to hold their feet to the fire. That's going to change here shortly, though, I think.
Well, I heard you telling that lady before, about here in a couple months, something might change for the better. And I'm looking to file mine within a couple months, actually.
Yeah, well, you got to see what's going on and where we are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, we're either going to get very much better, or you'll file it and they'll come to your house and pick you up. We'll be 100% communist, you know?
You know, I want to try to avoid that, because that's why I'm using all my language strictly constitutional, you know? I don't see how they, because, you know, when they force you and pull you over and try to give you contract and all that, They're forcing you into a public war is what they're doing. You know, they're invading. People don't know quite how
they've been doing a long time.
Yeah,
they've been violating us a long time. But anyway, it's an uphill battle. But you know, look, at education is power, and I think you're going to see some changes. And now, if there was ever a time for you to brush up on this stuff and get your common law and your Constitution and Bill of Rights down, it's now. Because that's going to be, when we go back into the rule of law, people that have schooled themselves in the law, i.e. the Constitution, Bill of Rights, are going to be ahead of the game. Look, the lawyers don't even know that stuff.
My intention.
The lawyers are going to be lost. They're going to be done. They're going to be out of job.
I know. I battled an attorney over in Alabama, and the old judge, he was sitting up there high in her seat, and she looked at me. I done been there once on the probable cause hearing, and I denied to cross the bar and all that going on to their ship. You know, all that language is true, but they don't like to hear it.
No, they don't. Then they say, oh, this guy's a nut. You know, he's one of them people.
Well, they were trying to paint me as that. And I told them, I said, I don't consent to none of this. That judge looked down at me, probable cause, said, if you don't show back up, I'm going to put you in jail. So, all right, so I showed back up on the next day. You know, a speedy trial right way out the door. Well, I did it. I did everything, same thing again, until I don't consent to none of this. This ain't right. She looked down at me and she said, so what do you want me to do with this? I said, I'd rather you cast out, you know, void as never existed. And the attorney that was trying to prosecute me, she never said anything. The judge was saying all of them, because the judge knew who she was dealing with, or somewhat. This attorney turned around and looked back at me, and her jaw dropped. I started walking out the door. And the judge spoke to me one last time. She said, so you think you know a little bit about constitutional law, huh? Well, you know, what's these old magistrate courts take silence as? You know, they take silence as guilty. Well, after that old magistrate asked me, you know, asked me that last question, I turned around in silence and walked out. So hopefully. But you know, I've been in this court system stuff to see this stuff. You know, I've tried all this patriot mythology stuff. All that's true, but it don't work in the court cell, really.
No, they don't want to hear it, and they can put you in cuffs and throw you in jail for contempt and all that stuff. So you have to be careful when you show up in their venue. You know,
you got to have a record. That's what I found. You got to have a record of everything because they want to silence your speech, and they know you. Mm-hmm. They know people don't put anything on the record before they go into the club or into the court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've learned that the hard way. I started writing petitions and putting it in before I go into court, and it's like, look here, you know, my word is there in the court system now.
Right, right.
And you stick to the facts and the law, the Constitution, and constitutions are very powerful. People need to check those out too.
Yeah, well, we have a fellow named Robert Schultz, and that's what his thing was. That the state constitution is very powerful, and people need to read it. And most people don't even know what's in their state constitution. So that's how he used to win his cases, by knowing the state constitution better than the lawyers did. He found out the states are violating their own constitution every single day.
Every day,
right? So anyway, you're in the you're in the devil's frying pan is all I can tell you, and hopefully.
Yeah, I've been through the fire a couple times, and I'm fixing to. My intention is to send some shockwaves through the judicial system, so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to come out, you know, come out of the frying pan.
But, well, just be careful. Don't end up in jail.
I've been doing this a few times, so I'm still here talking. So I'm doing something right. I feel like.
Yeah. Well, you get your feet under you. After a while, you get a good feel for it, and you know just how far you can push before you get in trouble too.
Well, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Good. We need more people to do it, and hopefully it becomes more common, like common law, and they'll get enough that we'll straighten them out.
That's why I'm calling it to kind of.
What state did you say you were in?
I'm down here in Georgia, but I got a case I'm going to be filing into the judicial system against Tennessee.
Okay.
They tried to frame me up as I was a drunk driver. There was no alcohol. I even got all the evidence to prove that, in their own words, there was no alcohol or anything around.
Hmm.
And reason why is because I stood on constitutional grounds. Dude pulled me over, and he wants to look at some private information papers, and I'm like, well, no, I don't consent to that, fella. You know, you got to have a warrant. Well, him and his buddy go back there and conspire, you know, two or three times, and then finally, that last time they come up and said, well, I got probable cause now. I'm like, well, what's your probable cause? He said, well, you're shaking and nervous. Yeah, but fella, I'm not shaking. I ain't nervous. And they go to demanding, and they're ready to pull guns. And I'm like, hold up here. So I challenged them on the Fourth Amendment. You know, they got to have
mm-hmm.
a warrant to check your private information and all. People just hand their stuff right over when they get pulled over. But you got to be willing to fight and go to jail too. That's
right. And you can get some lumps doing that, believe me, especially in those little towns where they've been controlling things for years and they're going to do things their way. You know, you run up against that, they don't care. I mean, look at some of those officials are the worst criminals. They're like mobsters, and they don't care if they put a bullet in your head to deal with you. You know what I mean? That's how bad they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
so just be careful with them guys.
Mm-hmm. I just want to call in and say that, you know, I enjoy reading y'all's website. Y'all got a lot of good information on there. You know, I even got the Magna Carta. I called in one time. You told me where the Magna Carta was, and I got that quoted in.
Yeah, we got tons and tons of stuff. You couldn't get through it in 10 years, I don't think, but it's all there. It's all there.
Two other books is the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. People ought to read those.
Yeah, I believe we have them. I believe they're on our site somewhere.
Yeah, I got Anti-Federalist from y'all's website.
Yeah.
I got a hardcover on the Federalist.
Right. That's you're ahead of the game than most people then. Okay.
I want to spread my knowledge out, see if I can help people out there. So.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the call.
No, very good. Nice talking to you. Have a good night.
I'm telling you. All right,
yeah. Bye. Okay. Good night. Okay, let me get back to my screen share here, if you will. Hang on just a minute. The queue is empty. I'm going to just introduce something in the last few minutes here because I think it's good information and it's something that I'm going through personally. So I'd like to present it because I know that other people in NLA are up against this right now. And I think it's very important that we educate ourselves with this stuff. And right now, my sister's still in the hospital, and they're still doing their COVID protocol trying to kill her. And there's things that you can do that I'm just learning now a little too late. But this is all good stuff that has come across my experience here with these hospitals that want to use the protocols that the CDC and Fauci put in are designed to kill people, and they're designed to make the hospital money. And I got a little and this, am I sharing screen? Hang on a minute. No, I still got anonymous on there. Hang on. I don't see my screen. Am I sharing screen? I lost my... Here we go. Let me try that again. I don't think it went. What's this?
Yes, Gerard, you're sharing your screen.
Do you see the doctor there with the mic in front of his face?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Well, it wasn't clear to me that it was showing. Okay. So this is a website. This guy is Dr. Artist. He's got a lot of good information. This is drartistshow.com. I recommend anybody that's got anybody sick with COVID to go here. He's a very good doctor. He gives wonderful advice, but he also gets into the legal aspects. And he brings people on, and he shows you how to control these hospitals. And when my sister went in, we did not want her on a ventilator, so no vent and no remdesivir, because the remdesivir is shutting their organs down and killing them. And they put them on, it guarantees a 5-day hospital stay, and they give them remdesivir, and it's $5,000 for treatment of remdesivir. That's why they push it. Just like they get $40,000 for putting you on a respirator. And they played with her so much that she ended up collapsing on the floor, and they found her on the floor with no heartbeat, and they had to CPR her to get her back in. And, of course, so she ended up on a machine because she wasn't breathing, and they had to put her on it. I mean, we did not have a DNR. We just said no ventilator, for COVID. So they ended up getting her on that machine, and they ended up giving her remdesivir against our wishes. And when somebody's going in for COVID, the first thing that you should do is you should get a healthcare proxy signed over to you or to somebody in the family, and a power of attorney, because when you can't breathe and you're not getting oxygen, she went in, her oxygen was down to 60. She shouldn't even been conscious at that point. She went below 60. And so what they did is she's confused. She had a hard time thinking. And so then they coerced her into approving the remdesivir, where if she had her middle son as her healthcare proxy, and he's young, he's like 22, 23, and he was not up for the job. He should have jumped on them immediately and said, "What are you doing, changing the orders without my permission?" See, that's, they said, "Oh, she made the decision herself." No, no, no. When somebody that they're taking advantage, when you come in that condition, so there's a lawsuit there, and that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in getting my sister out. But you need to understand some of the things that go on. I'm going to play this video. I'd like to get through. Now, this video is 51 minutes long, but I'm going to kind of push it in ahead. But everybody should go on this themselves, drartistshow.com, and sign up, and then you get to see my loved ones in the hospital. What do I do? This is stuff that you've never thought about before, and you need to think about it. Now, my sister was not vaccinated, but she worked in the healthcare system, and everybody around her was vaccinated. So she caught the spike protein, I believe. They told her she had microclots in her lungs. The only way you're going to get that is with the spike protein or the vaccine, and she had not taken the vaccine. So she caught this thing from vaccinated people, and you're going to hear more and more of that. That's the pandemic. That's the bioweapon, is this mRNA vaccine, this spike protein that they put in people, and it's going to start hitting us this winter, and that's going to be the epidemic. That's going to be the pandemic, and they're going to blame it on non-vaccinated people, but that's a lie from hell. There's never been a case of a person with no symptoms giving something to somebody. It's unheard of. But anyway, when they play this, so you get an idea.
Hey, Gerard?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention that. He talks about an NIH. You can go to NIH, Table 2E, I believe. And on there, there's a note. And it pushes remdesivir. And then it says, don't use ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine because it fights against the remdesivir.
Yeah.
And that is on the NIH site.
Right, right.
Okay.
And, I'll tell you what, if you go to these agencies and look at their sites, they damn themselves. They're so stupid, and they basically tell you what's going on. But there's another medicine too. I have to look it up, that they use in the place of remdesivir, because people aren't familiar with it, and so they get away with it, And I can't remember the name right now, but let me play the video and I'll find it while it's playing.
You need more volume, Gerard.
What's that?
You need more volume. We can't hear.
Each of which cause a high percentage of all people to experience acute kidney failure in less than 5 days and multiple organ failure, which is what they say COVID-19 patients are dying of in hospitals. They're dying of being poisoned to death by these drugs, just like my father-in-law was killed in a hospital here in Texas in early.
Can you hear that now? Is that better?
No.
No. I wonder how come it's going on. Hang on just a minute. I don't know why these are all up. This one is up.
It's pain and let him go. This is their attempt in hospitals, by the way, at palliative care. More pain, by the way.
That made it a little better, whatever you did. You need to more of it.
More pain is what they use in ICUs, not as palliative care. February 2020. This is how you kill and murder your loved ones, because morphine...
I'm sorry. It's better now, right?
It was slightly better.
I can't get it any more than that. I got everything up. Let's see. Let me just turn this off. Yeah, see, I'm all the way up here.
Yeah, there should be one for that video.
Yeah, right here.
No, there's another one for video audio inputs. There should be more than just that. Yeah, more like that. And they're up as high as they can go.
All of them. That's start meeting, because this is under start meeting. So I don't know. Maybe this is not a good one. I don't know. Maybe it's the way they taped it or what. Hey, let me just try something real quickly here. The speakers are disabled. So, yeah, it's on my... How about we try this? I've done this trick before. Let me see.
Before COVID ever even got to Texas. So, I have brought into the studio...
That's better than it was, but it's still not understandable.
This is Michelle Roten. And Michelle Roten actually owns her own...
That's not better, huh?
No, I'm afraid not.
I don't know what's the matter with this thing. Hang on. Time for a new computer.
I'm all for that. As you notice, the address is the AR.
DR dot. Right.
No, there's no dot.
Oh.
DR for doctor, ARDIS show. And
dot.
It took me a while to realize it was a D and not a T. And it
right.
One S.
Right.
So thedrartistshow.com.
Right, and then when you get in there, you can go to these links.
Right.
That'll bring you to the main site, and then you get to these links. Let me just try one more thing, Terry. Tell me if this is better.
Facility. Tell us about your facility.
Oh, fabulous.
And give us a little bit of your background.
Okay, I got to hold my mic next to the speaker, so I might not hear you, okay? I'm going to let it play. Let me back it up just a little bit more so he can give his introduction. This woman is an advocate that does this all the time. She's very good.
Top subject titles of my emails, thousands every week. Dr. Artis, please tell me, how do I actually get them to stop treating my patient or loved one with these protocols? Can you be my patient advocate? Who do I turn to? So this is why today, for the next, we got 16 more minutes in this segment. I need everybody to share this video. It's going to be recorded, but this is live. There are thousands of people right now being told by hospital doctors, by hospital administrators, that there's just one mandated protocol, and I've been educating y'all since May 2020 what this is and how this is a death-causing cocktail of what's called remdesivir and dexamethasone. That's the only treatments right now. Remdesivir is the killer. They're adding vancomycin now to this two-part protocol, so now it's remdesivir, dexamethasone, and vancomycin, each of which cause a high percentage of all people to experience acute kidney failure in less than 5 days and multiple organ failure, which is what they say COVID-19 patients are dying of in hospitals. They are dying of being poisoned to death by these drugs, just like my father-in-law was killed in a hospital here in Texas in early February 2020 before COVID ever even got to Texas. So I have brought into the studio, and I'm so excited, I'm going to let her roll. This is Michelle Roten, and Michelle Roten actually owns her own facility. Tell us about your facility in McKinney, Texas, and give us a little bit of your background. Michelle Roten is going to educate all of you on tips and what you exactly need to do to convey to the doctors and the hospital administrators who you need to get involved, what meetings you need to call for, what action you need to take to get the hospitals to actually side with you to support you. Welcome to the show, Michelle Roten. Please educate the audience.
Thank you. So I own Wonderfully Made Wellness Sanctuary in downtown McKinney. We do mostly kids there. We cater to the more naturally minded parents, and occasionally on Thursday mornings we see the parents because they beg us, and they want someone who can actually fix the root of their problem instead of just medicate them. So I actually spent 14 years in the NICU, the neonatal ICU, as a nurse, a charge nurse, a transport nurse, flying in helicopters, a safety expert, a nurse practitioner, all of those things. So I have crawled in and out of, I can't tell you how many hospitals, either as a provider or as a safety expert. And so I'm just very aware of how hospitals work. So when I came out of the hospital system years ago, because I just didn't agree with what was happening in there with the convalescent AIDS patients, I started providing advocacy services for parents that were in labor and delivery, postpartum, newborn nursery, neonatal ICU, all of those places that felt like they were being bullied or not listened to, or that their child wasn't receiving the best care, or they were trying to force them into something they didn't want their child to have. So that's pretty easy because parents are bulldogs. I mean, they're lions. They're all riled up, and I tell them what to do, and whoever is the meanest one just goes after it in the order I tell them, and instantly everything is the way they want it to be. It's pretty easy, 100% success rate there at all times, okay? So once all of this started with COVID last year, I started getting called, hey, can you provide advocacy services for this adult? And at first, it was the adults that just needed care in general in the hospital, and they were doing nothing because they were holding beds open for COVID, you know, when they had 48 beds filled out of 860 beds in the hospital. Then it starts, you know, so, and there was some COVID patient advocacy that was going on, but this year is way worse than last year. So I'm the same as you. I'm trying to have appointments with clients. I'm, you know, providing advocacy services for even nurses who are being bullied into the vaccine to keep their job. And I will pick up my phone and I have 27 text messages and 30 messages on Facebook and 45 emails and Signal and Telegram. And it's, or I'm picking up the phone at the office. Please, you're the only one that can help me. Can you please help me? They have my loved one in the hospital with COVID and they're not doing anything. They're doing nothing and they won't let us in. Nobody will communicate with us. He says that he's scared or he doesn't seem lucid to me, but they're telling me that he is lucid and they're getting consent for things from him, except for he's not in his right mind all day long. And so when you called me the other day, I went, yes, like I'm absolutely exhausted. And it's to the point where I'm only one person. I already like live on a farm and have my own kids and my own business and my own people that I'm taking care of. And so anyone that I can get to help, as long as we don't have someone circumventing us, that's always the problem with adults, we get our way, but man, the fight has been intense recently. And so my answer to that is the first thing I need you to do is call the unit and ask for the charge nurse and say, I am calling to let you know that I'm initiating the chain of command. I am not happy, I'll just use husband. I'm not happy with my husband's care. He is not lucid, and I'm telling you that he shouldn't be making his own medical decisions. Nobody is calling me from the medical team for updates or asking for my permission, and I feel like he is being medically neglected because you're not doing everything that you could be doing to make sure he gets better.
So this is important stuff. So she just mentioned, and I want everybody taking notes, and I want you sharing this video. This video is going to stay live. Anywhere that I actually send out documentation, anywhere that I'm speaking, I want to make references to this so people can look back and go, watch this over a 22-minute segment. The next 22-minute segment, this is going to go on for, you know, this whole day, this morning. So I want you to be able to convey to people what notes they need to take because, for example, I don't think I would have known before I knew you that the charge nurse is who I need to talk to first, right? This is what you're going to ask for. So please be very distinct in what you're telling these people to ask for. This is a great job. So charge nurse, once you contact the unit, is who you want to talk to, and then you want to tell them what?
Tell them that you are not happy with the care. You feel that the patient is being medically neglected. I do use those words, that not everything is being done that could be being done, that you have not been updated and talked to by the medical staff, which blows my mind that we can't, you know, communicate and update people. And that you need somebody to call you back right away. So when I initiate the chain of command, I always give a deadline, okay? Now, these people are really busy. They're very, very short-staffed because so much of the staff has left because of what's going on in the hospital. They either ethically cannot deal with this kind of chaos and BS anymore. They're not going to be vaccinated with this vaccine that is emergency use only, all of that kind of stuff. So when you're hearing we don't have enough beds, like there are more people in the hospital now, but they don't have enough staff to staff the beds. And you only have so many beds that you have staff for, right? So you always give a timeline, so I give an hour. I need somebody to call me back with an hour to let me know how we're going to rectify this situation. And you need to set your alarm, and right at an hour, you need to call back and say, hey, it's been an hour, nobody has called me back. I need to speak to your manager. I need the manager to call me back in 30 minutes. Otherwise, I'm going to have to come up here and we're going to do it in person. I respect that you're busy. I respect that there are a lot of patients, but I'm telling you that right now I don't feel like my family member is safe and you're not responding to me.
Very good.
Okay. So if it is during the day, during the week, the chain of command is one way. And if it's the nighttime or the weekend, the chain of command is a different way. And so you need to know that. When I have someone that's, my loved one's been in the hospital since Sunday and it's Friday at 4:45, can you please help me? I'm like, really? Like, we should have done this on Monday morning or Sunday, you know what I mean? So your chain of command in the hospital during the day, during working hours is, you know, first you have your nurse, but they're not going to be able to do anything. They're doing patient care. It's the charge nurse's job to handle problems, and you're going to be a problem. Like, I am a big problem for you is what you want them to understand.
And you need to be a big problem. They're actually,
you need to be a big problem. Honestly, if every family would stand up and be a big problem, the hospitals wouldn't have time for this. Okay? Like, they would be so overrun. I tried to make Facebook pages for hospitals in the area so that I could unite patients together, and Facebook keeps blocking me. Like, they're on to me, and they are protecting the hospitals at all costs. Okay? So your chain of command would be charge nurse, nurse manager of the unit. Do not let them direct you to the case manager. They have been kind of on to me at this point, or on to people in general, and I have people come back, well, I've been talking to the case manager. I'm like, the case manager is useless, like 0% power, negative power.
I'm just telling you right now, the audience that's listening, 90% of them have no clue about this.
Right. The case manager is a useless, okay? Their job is to make sure that things are organized for discharge and that they've charted so insurance or Medicare will cover the things, like, literally not helpful. I don't mind running over one if I need to that's trying to get in my way, but not helpful, okay? So charge nurse, nurse manager, then director. So usually you have directors of areas, okay? So you'll have directors of med-surg or directors of these sets of ICUs or directors of these sets of ICUs, right? So you'll have a bigger director. And then past that, you're looking at the administrative office. And so I always go through the chain of command just to show, like, I understand, like, I'm being respectful and I understand that you're busy and there is a way that we go about things in the hospital system. So that when I get to administration, I can say, I called the charge nurse at this time, nobody called me back. I called again, asked for the manager, nobody called me back. I called again and said, fine, I need the director. Or at this point, if you want to back up and have the manager call me, because I'm going to keep going and it doesn't have to get this out of control. At that point, if you're a strong person and you're giving them timelines and you're staying with it, you're going to get somebody to call you back. Otherwise, you just call the administrative office. And at that point, you know, I start using words like lawyers, families, team of lawyers. I'll hire my own private advocate, all of those things. Hospitals actually are supposed to provide you an advocacy service, an advocacy person through their own service line. And I do have people historically that'll say, well, why would I ask for an advocate from the hospital? Like, they're just going to side with them. That's really not true. That's really a trigger to them that if you have someone pull, like the patient pull that chain or the family member and say, hey, we need an advocate assigned to this situation because it's ugly over here. We're very, very unhappy. That is immediately a trigger that this could turn into a legal situation and nobody wants that because that's expensive.
So when you're talking, so just so I'm clear and the audience is clear, when you're talking to the charge nurse, when you're going up to the manager, when you're going up to the
director,
the director, and then to the admins, if you use the phrase, we need a patient advocate, or what's another term for the hospital's version of their patient advocate?
That's it. It's a patient advocate within their hospital. Now, I'm considered a privately hired patient advocate, and there aren't a lot of those out there. But honestly, it's not like I have a degree in that or I've had training in that. I just do it, and I know how to do it. So even if you are, say, my husband's in the hospital, this is not my personality. I'm not a strong-willed person. I'm a crier, whatever it is. If there is someone that watches this and is like, I got it, or they've done it for themselves, you can hire that person as your private patient advocate, just so you know. And it's another clue to them, like, okay, now they're going outside of the system for advocacy, which means the next thing we're going to have is a lawyer. At this point, when I've been dealing with people, they've already been pretty strong with them and they haven't gotten anywhere, I'm like, you need to go ahead and get a lawyer. So in Texas, we have Texas Right to Life, and they have lawyers, and so you just fill out a form online and then somebody calls you back. So once I've been in situations where there's myself and a Right to Life lawyer in the family conference, basically we get what we want. Even if they keep telling us no, they hang up, and then 30 minutes later they call back.
So this Texas Right to Know, there may be other groups like this in every state, right?
But there are lawyers everywhere who believe in patient rights, as they should. We have a patient bill of rights,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they believe in rights, and they're going to be willing to take the case, you know. But when you're talking to them, the first thing that you're saying is, I need someone to call me, okay? Then once you talk to the doctor, sometimes you get a doctor that's an a-hole, and they poo-poo everything that you're saying, and you're like, hey, you're not being a very nice person right now. I'm going to hang up. I'm going to call the manager back and say, that was not successful at all. Now I'm more fearful for my loved one's life than I was before. And so one option is I can go ahead and fire that doctor, which you can.
I have done this multiple times.
Position.
You've heard my stories. I have fired multiple doctors in the room of hospitals, and they had to walk out.
Yep. Okay. And so, but you're trying to get a family conference, and a family care conference would be like the nurse, the charge nurse, maybe the manager. Social work may be there, respiratory therapy, at least one of the physicians involved, if not two, so that you can get everyone on the phone and say, we're not happy with care. Okay, right now, that's the biggest battle. People don't know how to get to that point. Once everybody has to stop and make it to that point, and you have an audience and you've been that much of a squeaky wheel, right in that moment, you have way more of a chance to get the therapies that your loved one deserves than if you're just randomly talking to one person at a time.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell me what this meeting is again, where you have everybody together. What'd you call it?
We call it a family care conference.
And
a patient care conference for the family. But I'm sure they all have different variations, but they'll all know what you're talking about. That's the thing that we do.
One of the things I've been most surprised about over the last 20 years being involved with helping patients in practice and then representing my own family and children in hospitals, people don't realize, the majority of people have no idea what the rights of themselves or their loved ones or those of loved ones being treated in hospitals are. So in the next 40 seconds before this segment ends, can you just tell the audience some of the extension of some of their rights? What are patients' rights, families of loved ones who are patients' rights in hospitals? I don't think they know.
The biggest thing is informed consent. And when you have someone in the hospital on 50 liters of oxygen that's hypoxic, they're not lucid to give informed consent. They should be going to next of kin, or they should have had them sign a medical power of attorney when they walked in. If you have to drop someone off at the hospital, they immediately need to ask for a medical power of attorney form and sign it over to whoever the hard ass in the family is.
You're with Dr. Artist and the Dr. Artist Show. This is going to wrap up our first segment. Michelle Roten has been a wealth of information, and we're going to be back in just a few seconds.
Well, I'm going to stop it there. It's very good. The next video, this has another section before it ends, and it's very good, and there's three or four videos there. You have somebody in the hospital, or even if you don't, you may have, if you have people living home, people are getting sick right and left. You need to watch these videos. This is the second video. This is the third video. And there's all kinds of information here, all kinds of resources. This is a wealth of information. I just got this the other day. I wish I would have had this a week ago. Everybody needs to check it out, even if you're not sick, because it could happen to you or somebody you love tomorrow. So I just wanted to get that out there to our group, and I wish you would spread it to other people. Look, we have 8,000 people in NLA. This type of stuff needs to go viral, because this is all part of fighting the system, and this whole COVID thing is interwoven with all the rest of our rights that we've lost. It's interwoven with the voter fraud and everything else. They had to push the COVID in order to get the write-in vote so that they could play games to throw the election. So it's all connected, and you can battle at any level, and certainly if you got a loved one in trouble, that's a good place to battle. That's where God put you. He expects you to do that job. And with tools like this, you should be able to do it. So all that being said, it's 12:07. I'm going to sign off. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And we'll see you next week. And, bring us your stories. If you got somebody in the hospital and you do this and it's successful, get on the call. Let us know. Okay, God bless. And we'll see you next week, same time, same station. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.